This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Why, Johnny Tyler! Madcap!
Doc?
Where are you going with that shotgun?
I didn't know you was back in town.
Well, well. How the hell are you?
Wyatt, I am rolling.
Morgan.
Doc.
Virgil.
Ooh, Doc.
Wyatt Earp.
Going into business for ourselves, Doc. Well, I just got us a Pharaoh game.
Oh. Since when is Pharaoh a business?
Didn't you always say that gambling's an honest trade?
No, I said poker's an honest trade. Only suckers buck the tiger. The odds are all on the house.
Depends on how you look at it. I mean, it's not like anybody's putting a gun to their head now, is it?
That's what I love about Wyatt. He can talk himself into anything. Oh, Johnny, I apologize. I forgot you were there. You may go now.
Just leave that shotgun. Leave it.
Thank you.
Sheriff Behan.
Gentlemen.
Sheriff. Have you met Doc Holliday?
Kiss on you, Wyatt.
It is 25 minutes after the hour of 1, and this the month of December, the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live, I say, from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milk-packing district of glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us and drawing near that ye might be entertained, amused, and a little bit smarter before this whole program is done. It is Wednesday, December 15th, 2010, and welcome to Day 12. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today. 503-505-6964. The great on-turning of the phones happens right... Wait. There we go. All right. Fantastic. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached. That is don@rickemerson.com. DAWN@rickemerson.com. Chat box is open. You can message us via Skype if you like. That's Rick Emerson Show at Skype. Let's see. And I don't know what all. And there you go. That's kind of how you do it. That's how the game is played, kids. It's 503-505-6964 for your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ponderings, musings, ruminations, whatever it is you might have on this Wednesday. Here's what's coming up on our end of things. We have a... I wrote down the phrase meat watch, and that's not really what I meant to put. It's not a meat watch so much as it is a hick watch coming up, but I have an observation about the word meat that I'm going to get to in just a second. Okay. It's not like of any great political or social import or anything, but I'm going to get to it. We got your hick watch coming up later in the day. Nazi watch on the way. I got to get the theme ready for that. Oh my God, I wasn't even ready. We got the Nazi watch coming up. Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. That is a double installment, by the way. The Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas coming up. Let's see. What else? Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be in the studio with us. We got your... What's going on over there?
I was just trying to see if I could sign into Skype and if I could, like, message you on Skype from over here with my phone.
There's no reason you couldn't do that. I can answer that question right now.
I know, but I've never been successful, like, signing into Skype so far. It just doesn't...
Is it the typing your name part that gets in the way of things? Or?
Well, before it just kept rolling. It kept doing that I'm loading, and never loading when I was at the hospital. And then this time it didn't like my password, so I may have either mistyped my password or... forgot.
Here's the thing you'll find about typing in passwords on a smartphone, in my experience, and this is not just like an iPhone discussion. I feel compelled to note at the beginning so everybody doesn't get their goddamn panties in a wad. This has to do with smartphones in general, because my wife, you know, she has the Android phone, and it same thing. In a strange way, I actually mistype my password more often on the phone, where it actually shows the letter for a fraction of a second, and then it goes to the asterisk, as opposed to like on your keyboard or whatever, where it doesn't show it at all, where you just have to sort of, you have to hope that you've hit the right key if you weren't actually looking at it.
Well, with the iPhone, since you hit the thing on the touchpad, like my big fat fingers are covering up the thing that pops up to show me what the letter is. I hit half the time anyway.
Now, do you type sideways or how do you orientate the phone?
I tap it with my finger.
No, but do you hold the phone vertically or horizontally?
This way.
Oh, see, that's the thing is I do all horizontal. I do the all horizontal typing because then I can just type with two, you know, then it gives you a wider display for one thing. You get a much bigger display of the letters there.
Okay.
Why would you not be typing? Only a fool types vertically, Dawn. You sicken me. Get out of my sight.
I'm a noob.
Yeah. The best part of it was you had exactly the right vocal inflection for that. Well done. I played, by the way, that Tombstone, because that was just for you.
Oh, thank you.
Because I know that you fancy it.
I do.
God damn, it's the best movie.
You're my Huckleberry.
I was gonna snark for just a second and say that I was playing it for Scott Daly. Of course, that would be ironic because he doesn't appreciate that movie.
Something wrong with him.
Now, have you? Not that I encourage you to do this because it's just tiresome and you want to punch him. But it's like, have you ever asked him his thing about Tombstone?
No, I heard you guys talking about it once on the radio back in the day when he used to be on Fridays, and I heard the two of you hashing it out, and I just sat there the whole time just going, "You're wrong, Scott Daly, you're wrong," yelling at the radio.
There in slack-jawed amazement and disgust as he was going on about how he didn't care for Tombstone, but Wyatt Earp was really an underrated film.
Yeah.
And I...
See, that's the nail in the coffin right there, is because I will admit that my beloved Tombstone is a mess of a movie. It's inconsistent, it's illogical, it was like written by three or four different people, there's dialogue that makes no sense, there's continuity errors, but you know something? I love that movie. I will admit, though, It is a deeply flawed film.
Now, see, I have
Wyatt Earp, on the other hand, sucks. It just sucks.
In every way.
In every way.
There's no redeeming qualities about it whatsoever. Now, here's the thing. I would never make the argument that Tombstone is like great art or anything. I mean, clearly it's just and when I say just a piece of entertainment, there's nothing wrong with that. Entertainment is it's a valuable thing. But I mean, it is meant to amuse as opposed to inform or to educate. I mean, it's a movie that does one thing and does it really well. But I got to say though, and maybe I'm just not the brightest bulb in the bank, but I don't know that I've ever really noticed anything that is deeply flawed about it in a sort of objective sense.
Well, I mean, first of all, the movie would have you believe that all of the Earp brothers arrived in Tombstone at the same time and then immediately walked across the street and bought the bar.
Oh, well, are you talking about...
Right, like, off the train.
But see, that's the sort of thing that I can forgive, though. I thought you were... I mean, it's because within the universe of the movie, that all makes sense.
But, I mean, there's also problems within the film itself, like... There's this interesting weird thing where there's the horrible, horrible sequence with Kurt Russell and Dana Delaney riding around on the horses.
That mare's in season.
Yeah. And then we go to something, and then a whole bunch of things happen. I can't remember what happens, but a bunch of stuff happens. And then like 10 minutes go by, and there's a scene where he comes riding into town to ride up to the brothers. And he's wearing, like, the shirt and no vest and everything that he was wearing in the Dana Delaney scene. And you realize... Oh, this was originally supposed to happen right after that other scene that within the context of the movie actually happened like yesterday. There's a lot of continuity problems like that. There's the...
This is maybe why I don't watch movies too closely, because things like that then just escape me and my enjoyment is untarnished.
There's the whole Billy Zane, Brandon Walsh relationship that goes on. And it seems kind of obvious, since I've seen Tombstone about 47 times.
Well, so it's a gay thing.
It's a gay thing, but also I think that originally there was some kind of a subplot going on there. Because the thing is, those characters disappear for like the whole last 45 minutes, and then all of a sudden there's Billy Zane on this wagon, and he's been shot. And Jason Priestley is like, oh, no. And you're kind of all, you suddenly thought, oh, yeah, those characters.
Now, see,
they
were
in the movie.
But see, but that, again, that's never struck me as odd. That is never, because that's, I can't believe I'm making this argument about Tombstone, because that's how life works, Don. People drift in and out of your realm of consciousness. People are on your radar. They're off your radar. They vanish for weeks at a time. Not everybody is on, like, stage in your life every moment of every day.
Well, the thing is, again, I am saying that I love this. I love the movie. I love Tombstone passionately. But there are things that I have always noticed from the very first time I saw it where I just go, one of my favorite things, just one of those little Tombstone moments. I think it sort of sums up a lot of what's wrong with the movie. Dana Delaney gets off the stagecoach.
Right.
And she turns around and she looks down the thing, and all the Earp brothers are standing there. And she says, who's that tall drink of water?
Right.
And then it cuts to a shot of Kurt Russell and Bill Paxton and Sam Elliott all standing. And you're thinking to yourself, which one?
Oh, see, but see, again, you're just...
Which one?
No, it's because it's so evident that the aura... I can't believe I'm turning into a woman as I speak here. If it's just that Wyatt Earp gives off an aura, which clearly, mm-hmm. Billy Zane, as a close friend and confidant of Dana Delaney's character, he would automatically know
right.
which man she is attracted to. So he doesn't need to ask. He just says, oh, you have a keen eye, my lady, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
He has the look of both predator and prey, or that whole stupid thing he says.
But the thing is, she says, tall drink of water, and you cut down there, and actually, Sam Elliott is taller than Kurt Russell.
That's a figure of speech. He's not a drink of water, either. Why does he have to be tall?
And then there's that whole thing with the...
looking for reasons to hate, Don.
That he rides a pale horse thing that goes on, and then Kurt Russell is riding like a black horse, and so that the pale horse thing makes no sense.
Yeah, I think you're just straining at a gnat, as the good book would say. No, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I love the movie. I know you love the movie.
I do.
But I'm saying within the context of the film, none of these things. See, there are movies that I can watch and that I enjoy and that I know they're terrible. I know they're awful. Here's a good example of that: Airheads with Brendan Fraser. Now, granted, that's awful on a whole different scale. Any Oliver Stone film made after Nixon. Is terrible. And really, before Nixon, because that's the last great Oliver Stone film, in my opinion. Not necessarily the high watermark of his career, but that's the last film that Oliver Stone made that was solid all the way through. But even before he got the Nixon, it's like every third film was good, but the rest were just crap. I mean, they were just poorly written, and characters did things that made no sense. And suddenly it's like, I have to leave the room now, and then come back and give expository dialogue, and then vanish so that there's a plot point to be hinged upon. And it's, I mean, JFK is full of that stuff, obviously. But Tombstone, I just view a lot of that as just being sort of flowery language for its own sake, which I will forgive a lot for that, for the sake of dialogue.
I actually don't really have a problem with the messiness of Tombstone. It's just that I've always been very aware of the messiness of Tombstone. And the inconsistency of quality throughout it, just like the dialogue and stuff. Because part of the problem is the movie was originally, it was written by the guy, and I can't remember these men's names, I never can, but it was written by the guy who wrote and directed Glory. With Matthew
Morgan
Broderick
Freeman,
and Morgan Freeman. And he wrote it, and he was originally supposed to direct it. And what happened was he directed a few scenes, but then...
Then he went blind or something, didn't
he? No, Costner announced that he was making his Wyatt Earp movie.
Right.
And the studio put, like, this huge rush on it.
Get it done!
And kicked the Glory guy off and brought in the guy who made Rambo.
Awesome.
George Costanessinus.
Right.
And had him direct it. And he directed about three quarters of it. And obviously whole things of dialogue were rewritten and scenes where the Billy Zane character just disappeared. And that all just happened because of this whole, you know, cluster F of like getting this movie done so that they could beat the Kevin Costner movie into
the
theater.
And I didn't know that. I didn't know it was so made by committee. Because if you watch... I forget if this is on the commentary or not, but I mean, if you watch the commentary, maybe they allude to that, maybe they don't. It's been a while since I've actually listened to it with the commentary track. The one thing I do remember them saying is that, it's like shades of Woody Allen, where I think like it was either like this, like the director of photography or somebody, literally like went blind halfway through the shoot or something. Like he lost, and they had to, and he was like, it's sort of like what happened with is it Spielberg's director of photography or somebody that went lost his sight or you know his sight degenerated to such a point he couldn't do anything, and so they were working off sketches. He would sort of describe
oh, God.
I think it was Spielberg's director of photography, would describe the way the scene was supposed to be lit and to look, and he would give these very, very detailed, he would dictate these detailed notes, and then they would have to light basically according to how he described it. And I think the same thing kind of happened with Tombstone, where it's like three quarters of the way through, the guy just had like macular degeneration that went into overdrive, and then it's just like he woke up one day and just a whole swath of black. And so then they had to kind of puzzle their way through the... I guess maybe, you know, given all of this, it's a miracle that the film works at all. And it does. The thing about Tombstone is, Tombstone is a very... I mean, even assuming, and I take... I agree with some of the points you make. I take issue with a few of you. A few of the things that you see as errors or that you see as clumsy, I either don't or I can forgive. Again, like the whole thing about the pale horse and, you know, and death was in hell followed with him. Like, to me, I can just sort of, like, it, I hear that and I just, you know, I don't expect it to be shown literally. Hmm. It's just a cool, you know, it's just some cold-ass stuff that you say before you put a bullet in a guy or whatever it is that the Jewel says. But Tombstone is the very embodiment of that whole, if you just do something with enough force and style and panache and confidence, it totally works. Because there's enough set pieces in Tombstone and enough shots that are constructed... Like that whole sequence where they're coming, it's where they're going to the gunfight of the OK Corral. And I know that's not accurate, like in any way. I know that the whole gunfight of the OK Corral is so, so incorrectly depicted in terms of history.
Well, pretty much everything in this particular version of that legend is incorrect, with the exception of just, you know, the basics.
That they lived. It that
happened.
They existed.
There was a town called Tombstone. That was the name of the casino they owned.
But you
that's
know
pretty
what?
Much about it.
But when you see those four guys walking down the street and they're like black dusters, it doesn't matter.
And that scene is shot just amazingly.
It's so well done.
No, there's great stuff in that movie, and I love the actors, and they all are just completely committed to it. And Val Kilmer is just a genius. Absolute genius.
I have carried a grudge on his behalf forever that he did not win some sort of an award. I don't even think he was nominated for Tombstone, because it's like, who's ever, you know, because you've got, because it's got to be some sort of deconstructionist metaphor to ever be nominated for anything.
Yeah, Tombstone was seen as pop culture trash, really,
which is
when,
just,
it was when it was released.
Too bad. I mean, you could do like a top five of, you know, even if you assume that Tombstone was a bad movie, which you and I mean, we sort of, you know, you think it is, but it isn't.
No, I do not think it's a bad movie. I think it's a messy movie. And there's a big difference.
Okay. So, but I mean, even if we assume that it's just popcorn entertainment, just a tentpole picture, you know, you could do like a top five of overlooked fan, you know, over, even if it were somehow a bad film, you could do a list of the best performances in a bad movie, and Kilmer would be on there. I also have this whole, now we're just doing a whole Tombstone thing, but I have this whole theory about Tombstone and about Val Kilmer's accent as Doc Holliday, which is, because the thing is, I resisted seeing that movie for the longest time, because I saw Unforgiven, which came out a couple years before that, I think, or at the very least, I had not seen Tombstone, and I had seen Unforgiven. And I think, like a lot of people, I know that that's a divisive movie, but I really love Unforgiven. A lot of people don't. I know a lot of people don't care
really
for
care
it.
I don't really care for it.
And see, and I...
There is stuff in it I love, but I don't really care for
it. I'm kind of a sucker for Clint Eastwood, and I am also a sucker... I'm a real big... It's easy to get me with deconstructionist works. Things that, you know, that take you know, the tropes and the stock sort of characters and situations of movies, and then try to subvert them and sort of turn them inside out. And you can argue about how well that was done. But I went through a period where I sort of felt like... where kind of the final word had been said on the subject of Westerns, that there really was not any point to making another Western for quite some time. And I had a friend of mine who was just a freak for Tombstone, and he just kept nagging me to watch it. I'm like, Tombstone, Schmoomstone, you know, whatever. And then I finally was in when I had moved to Salt Lake, and I was just sitting there in the Shiloh, because I didn't have an apartment yet. So I'm sitting in the Shiloh Inn just staring at the ceiling, you know, just like picking my toenails and with nothing to do and didn't know anybody in the city and didn't know anywhere to go. And I flipped around and I caught it just as it was starting. And it was is it Robert Mitchum that does the narration?
Yeah.
And he's doing that. And they were called the Cowboys. And I was like, well, what the hell is this? And then I just saw the Tombstone, and I went, well, fine. And I just ordered, like, you know, I just ordered, like, some, you know, like, some things from, you know, like, some crap from room service and just sat there and watched it. And I was just, so utterly just entranced by the movie. Like, about 30 minutes in, I was just totally sold on it. So he and I had this, you know, we had this whole long discussion about it and about Val Kilmer. And I have this whole theory about Kilmer's accent as Doc Holliday. It is that Kilmer learned to do his Doc Holliday accent by listening to Jim Croce records. And if you listen to like Bad Bad Leroy Brown, or especially if you listen to Croce's recording of You Don't Mess Around with Jim, listen to the way Croce sings that, and then you listen to Doc Holliday. And I swear to God, it's the same accent. So he either modeled his accent on Jim Croce, or Croce is from wherever Doc Holliday is supposed to be from. Because I think that is the thing where he was a dentist, and yeah. then he kind of gave it up and he moved out to live a life of adventure. I think that actually is true. I don't know how true it was that he was, like, you know, the surest shot in the West or whatever, but I think he was a dentist who had TB and decided, like, F this, I'm gonna go live while I'm alive, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I played that for you because it's been a stressful week or so.
It has.
And I mean, really, what's going to put a smile on your face like a tombstone? I do, by the way, like the fact that they have the whole gay subplot there with...
He's the prettiest man I ever seen.
Is it Luke Perry or Jason...
Jason Priestley.
Jason Priestley. I can never tell them apart. Yeah. Jason Priestley. And I love Billy Zane, who, by the way, I mean, I don't know if that guy's gay in real life, but I got to tell you...
No, he's not.
Are you kidding me? Really?
He is not.
He just seems so unbelievably flaming, like, in every... That was when I was watching... That's one of the things that took me out of Titanic.
He's
like
just
a movie
pretty.
That's filled
that's
with
it.
Flaws.
He's just insanely pretty.
Because he's got those sparkling blue eyes. Yeah. It's like he's just... He's got, like, those Paul Newman eyes, and he's just got, you know... Plump, luscious lips.
Yes.
He really is an astonishingly beautiful man. What is his...
Listen to your friend Billy Zane.
What's his deal? What is his background? I mean, what is his culture...
Not sure.
Nationality-wise, or what are you supposed to call that?
I really don't know.
He's kind of got that Vin Diesel thing where he's like from everywhere and nowhere. He's just exotic and gorgeous.
And even like that, and he's one of those guys that he started going bald, and he was just like, I'm beautiful, I will embrace my baldness and just shave my head.
It's... Like that whole sequence in Titanic, and again, you want to talk about a movie that I love, but which I know is terrible in many ways. I mean, there are so many things wrong with Titanic, and I love that movie. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I blubbered like a small child when I saw it in the theater. Did the same thing when I saw it again, and I've watched it several times since then. And I just end up just weeping like a school child when everything. By the time I will never let go. And the credits are rolling and whatever. I can even get with the whole Celine Dion singing the song at the end, and I'm still just dissolving into a pile of watery goo in my seat. But that whole sequence where he's trying to get Rose, he's trying to get Kate Winslet to give up the sex, and she won't. And he reaches down and he puts his hand there and goes, "There's nothing I wouldn't deny you. If you don't deny me." And he just seems so unbelievably fruity.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no... which is fine.
I might
care.
Be wrong. I've always thought he was straight, but I could be wrong.
God,
I don't know.
Didn't he make the Phantom?
Yes, he did.
Oh, that's so sad.
He wore purple tights.
Oh.
And rode a horse.
Punch out, evil! All right, well, in any event... I don't even know what I was going to say about meat. Well, in any event, we get the Nazi Watch coming up today. Hick Watch. Ms. Kelly Clark will be here from Willamette Week. Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas, and we'll do the... Top five. We got your top five songs with sick in the title. That is for your husband, Patrick, who I was going to say your ailing husband, but he's now, can we say now he is your recovering husband?
Yes, he's
Patrick.
On the mend, I believe we can say that. He had his, he had some slits put into his abdomen and had his gallbladder sucked out of his body.
Did they really put it in just a series of little holes?
Yeah, that's what they do. They do a little incision that's only like an inch or two long. And then they have a couple of other holes that they put, like, the little camera, the little 2B cameras in, so they can see what they're doing and stuff. And then they just take it out through the slit.
Do they cut it up inside and then extract it, or do they, like, does it compress as they pull it through the hole?
I don't know. I guess it compresses. Because they said that his was actually a little difficult to remove because it was inflamed and damaged. And I guess, I don't know what this means, but one of the reasons I took it out is that the walls of his gallbladder had gotten thick, which I don't know what that means. But that made it, I guess, harder to go through the hole. So,
all right. I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what the upshot of your gallbladder walls being thick.
I don't either.
even is.
But they've got like the pathology people are apparently slicing it up into bits and looking at it under a microscope as we speak.
Come in here and look at this. Have you ever seen anything like this?
I wish I could. I wanted to be there, but you can't.
No, they won't let you.
You can't say, could I come into the pathology lab and watch you cut up my husband's gallbladder?
Oh, you don't want to be there for the surgery, but like for the cutting up.
Yeah, no, I don't want to watch him actually laying there cut up. But yeah, no, I'd like to like watch them dissect the gallbladder later. That would be cool.
It seems like if it wasn't going to raise the prospect of lawsuits and raise liability insurance costs, hospitals are always trying to scrape money by, because as much as they charge, it's like the hospitals are so expensive to run because they do have to pay out for things and people who file malpractice suits and things like that. And, the insurance system is all wonked up in this country. if it wasn't for the fact that they would undoubtedly be used as, you know, some sort of a deposition, it seems like they could make a tidy profit by selling you a videotape of your own surgery.
Yeah.
Because it's like you can film the kid being born or whatever, and I don't know why you want to do that, but I mean, what? Do you know anybody who has ever gone back and watched that, like themselves being born? No.
No.
Do you know a husband and wife who have ever gone back and watched it? No.
God, I hope not.
I have no idea what, to me, and I know it seems like an obvious comparison, I guess, but to me, the filming of the people being born, that's like to guys who take pictures at the funeral. Like, I don't get, and I've been that bad when Lara's grandmother died. Like, her freako cousin was there with his camera doing, like, some weird, you know, zoom-in, zoom-out thing with his camcorder as the grandmother's laying in the casket. And I have no idea what the hell that's all about. Same thing with watching some kid being squeezed out of a small opening. Like, in what circumstance are you ever going to go back and, like, put on some popcorn and watch that thing all the way through?
I've never been one to document things anyway, just to go back and look at them later. I mean, now that, you know, with the social networking stuff, it's like I've been taking pictures and posting stuff about this whole process with Patrick in the hospital. But a lot of that is also that helps keep, like, people and, like, his family who are in other states and all that sort of thing in the loop of what's going
on. Without having to call you and have a lot of phone calls. But tell me what's going on. Tell me everything.
I don't have to, like, write a bunch of emails and make a bunch of phone calls and that sort of thing. And, you know, hopefully I'm entertaining the peoples a little bit while I'm doing it, or just also letting people know what's going on.
Vent a little bit, too.
But the thing is, as far as just, like, birthday parties and Christmas and going on vacations and things like that, I have never been one to take pictures because I know I'll never look at them later. I don't care. I was there. I have the pictures in my head.
Well, and even if you look at the pictures later, it never does justice to the actual thing.
No.
I mean, that's the deal. You know, it doesn't matter how, you know.
You're just going, yep, that happened.
Yeah, you know, Lara went to, you know, she went to Turkey and Spain and whatever. And there's, you know, they got some culture there, I guess, and stuff. They got some buildings that are old. And so she, you know, saw like some pile of dirt from 50,000 years ago where a guy stood and did a thing and whatever. And she herself was the first one to say, she's like, I'm taking these because my mom demands to see them. She's like, but there's no way that a photograph is ever, not even the Museum of Ham can accurately be represented by the photograph. There's just no getting around it.
You did a fine job, though, on your Utah trip of documenting moments of your Utah
trip.
Well,
see, but that again is a thing where I'm just trying to share my pain a little bit, trying to give everybody a little bit of window into the particular slice of hell in which I was imprisoned.
I would never have known about flirty aprons.
How creepy is that?
If you hadn't done that.
You know, I got to give it up to Lara, by the way, because I saw, we were at the mall, we were at the Cottonwood Mall, which is near, I believe it was the Cottonwood Mall, which is near her home in Provo. And because it's like, she can only last in that, you know what it is? It's like those guys who do the free diving guys who dive down to get pearls or something. And it's like they've been raised in a culture where they can hold their breath for 7.5 minutes because it's their families have lived in Barbados and surrounding areas for generations. But even those guys, I got to get out of the water every now and again. Even Lara, growing up in Provo, she can only take so long in that house before she has to get out. And so we were there for a couple hours. She pulled the ripcord. She's like, let's go to the mall. I got to get out of this place. And so we go to the mall. We're walking around. And it's just so weird because, like, every third store just sells nothing but, like, Mormon jazz. You know, it's just, it's all, like, Mormon kits, you know, and, like,
I didn't realize that they actually had the missionary kits.
Oh, yeah.
And that was awesome.
Oh, the amount of
two suits and 8 shirts and 5 pairs of socks.
$695 they charge for that. And that's at Mr. Mac. So that's, like, a low-end kind of a... If you were to look at a pie chart of the Utah economy, the percentage of things in Utah that depend, financially speaking, that depend on missionaries and missions, I mean, is just immense. There are whole services that do nothing but will get your letters to your missionary, like in Buenos Aires, like the next day, or that, will specialize in delivering packages to them somewhere, or that will help create, again, photo albums or memory books, you know, for like, you know, here's my time in Belize or something, you know, because that's a thing that everybody sits around and they want to tell you about their mission when they went to, like, you know, when they went to Chile or something. There's an entire culture there. By the way, if you drive down the highway, like if you're going to Provo, you go on I-15 to get to Provo. First, you pass the state prison, but then you just start to see a lot of billboards that, again, are for nothing but like missionary services and a lot of billboards that still say, stop the mosque at ground zero. Right next to a picture of like the World Trade Center imploding and a thing that says remember 9/11. So it's a strange place. It really is. I haven't even posted all of the photos. I got a couple more that'll stick up in like a dump at the end of the week. I got to hand it to Lara though, because we were at the mall and I saw that flirty aprons kiosk. And I was just busy photographing and observing how sad and self-deluded it was. And then she was the one who actually spotted flirty aprons like for kids.
Yeah.
Or whatever, which is just
little girl flirty apron.
Just so creepy. Just so creepy in every way. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Wednesday.
The man who shot up a Florida school board meeting had issues. Mark Zuckerberg is Time's Person of the Year. And we have new inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Awesome. And I don't know who they are. And I got to say that a couple years ago, I moved on from actually caring. Managed to emotionally separate myself from that issue. But I am kind of curious, and so we'll find that out later. In just a few minutes, Kelly Clark will join us via the telephone. Kelly Clark of Willamette Week. Got your top five coming up later on. Hick Watch, Nazi Watch, all of that. Don't forget today's Rick Emerson Show brought to you by Sorrell's Vintages. That is 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. That is 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, directly across from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. We'll talk more about that here in just a bit. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, before we move on, I want to read this particular story. I've been holding on to this for a day or two. In an effort to promote condom use, the Philadelphia Department of Public Health Division of Disease Control is sponsoring a contest to design its prophylactic wrappers. The competition, which has been extended to January 14th, invites artists to submit designs with a, quote, unique and positive message, said Carol Johnson, director of the Disease Control Division. The winning design, as chosen by online voters, will adorn the wrappers of at least 500,000 condoms that the city distributes. The city hands out about 1 million free condoms each year at health clinics, schools, and other locations, and it aims to double that total in 2011. Philadelphia has a high rate of sexually transmitted diseases, like chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. Compared with residents from the rest of the state, city residents are about five times more likely to have chlamydia, six times more likely to have gonorrhea, and 40 times more likely to have syphilis.
Well done.
According to the city health department.
Hey, here's a dumb question. Maybe I should know this. I guess maybe they wouldn't have taught me this in health class. I was watching, I told Jim back on the thing of powering through House, trying to get all caught up and whatever, because I know a little bit about what comes up in the next couple seasons, and that's sort of interesting to me. So I'm kind of getting through where I am right now. I'm powering through the end of this season, then I'm going to, you know, and then I'm going to buckle down and try to catch up with the rest of humanity. But there was this episode last night where there was some hooker that came in. Anyway, but he was talking about her having the clap. What is the clap?
That's gonorrhea.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. Because I just assumed it was like syphilis, I guess, because that's the one that they always talk about on the medical shows. It's like it'll blind you.
Gonorrhea is the clap.
And that's a thing you don't want, presumably.
No, you don't want either, really.
But so the clap isn't like a catch-all term for sexually transmitted diseases. It's not like just some oldster's term for like when you've got something bad going on.
No, traditionally it meant gonorrhea. I don't know if kids today just use it for anything that's drippy and burny, but
I have no idea. It just occurred to me that I had because I don't think they ever actually said the name of the illness. He just meant like a clap on, clap off joke, and I thought, well, what the hell is that? And then it was yet another place where my Catholic education failed me. So here is Don Taylor.
Let's do our Nazi watch.
Here is your Nazi watch for Wednesday, December 15th, 2010, right here in the Rick Emerson Radio program.
CBS. Oh,
I think I've forgotten to edit out the in color part of this. Awesome. All right, here's your in color. I'm going to use that at the beginning of tomorrow's show.
Oh, please do. I like that.
I'm going to edit that out and use that tomorrow. All right, without further ado, here is your Nazi watch for December 15th. Here is Don Taylor.
A Riverside County school district is facing a possible lawsuit after banning a clothing line marketed by a well-known dirt bike stunt team whose logo includes Nazi-type imagery.
Nope.
Many school districts already ban gang or hate-related paraphernalia and symbols in their dress code policies, but now several schools in the Inland Empire in California, including the Murrieta Valley Unified School District, have specifically banned clothes from the Temecula-based Metal Militia, M-U-L-I-S-H-A, Riders.
Now, is that what that organization is? Because I see, in fact, just while we were in Utah, Laura and I saw a truck that had the Metal Militia thing on it. And she said, well, what? She said, because it's spelled in like a handwriting sort of thing. And she said, well, what does that even mean? And I thought it was like a Metallica thing or a band thing. But
no, it's a clothing line banned by a bunch of dirt bike guys.
Okay, all right.
Actually, and there's a photo of the logo on rickemerson.com/pictures.
I've seen this. So what is the actual imagery in question?
I said, because, well, let's see. Where
I mean, did they say, like, is it an Iron Cross or something?
Well, it's the T-shirts and hats featuring Nazi-style helmets and a lightning bolt S, like those worn by the SS. Although it's actually, it looks like they've done, like, an MM for metal militia and made it look like kind of like the lightning bolt S for the SS. You know, and it's like skulls with helmets, you know, army helmet kind of things. Yeah, they are kind of Nazi-ish.
Nazi-esque. You know?
When you look at the symbols, they're obviously they're identical to Nazi symbols, said Karen Paris of the school district. Students are threatened by that, and our main goal is to provide a safe learning environment, she said.
So this is where, in California?
Yeah, in California.
All right. Well, first of all, it's not like the Nazis had a trademark on wearing, you know, a helmet or something. I mean, I think that's sort of a widespread practice in our militaries.
Yeah, yeah. American military guys in World War II wore those green metal helmets of that exact type. So, after receiving warning letters of a possible lawsuit from MM Compound Incorporated, the licensee of the metal militia brand, Murrieta Valley school officials are reconsidering the dress code policy and seeking a compromise. The letter sent to the superintendent in September dismissed the association of the brand with racism and Nazism and demanded the district end its ban. The company actually sent letters warning of a possible lawsuit to the school district.
Now, is this this photo that's in the photo gallery right here, and you can go to rickemerson.com/pictures, and it's the visual aids for December 15th. Is this a representative example of their art? Because this doesn't look Nazi
at all.
It's like a skull with a hat, basically.
Right.
All right. Yeah. No, that's ridiculous.
No, this is people seeing Nazis where Nazis don't actually exist.
All right.
And in fact, I don't have it on this story particularly, but I think like some kid they talked to from the high school also pointed out, you know, the band Kiss uses like letters like that too. Yeah. And nobody thinks they're Nazis.
The only people who buy here's the strange thing about that. The only people who think that they are the Germans themselves, who actually won't allow the Kiss logo to be displayed in Germany. That is a fact. Any Kiss merchandise or paraphernalia, or when the band tours, if they are in Germany, they have to actually use a modified version of the logo where they look more like Z's as opposed to lightning bolts, because it is illegal to display the Kiss logo as it is currently drawn in the country in Germany.
Oh.
Hey, we still don't say East and West Germany now, do we?
I don't think so. No.
Is it just Germany?
I think it's. Just
I don't know if maybe they were unified, but we still kept those designations. If it was like their version of 39th or Cesar Chavez Boulevard.
It might be, but I don't know. But I mean, they're not separate countries anymore. So.
All right. There's your Nazi watch for I'll just play the whole thing again because I like it. All right. Here's your that's your Nazi watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
CBS presents this program in color.
That's awesome. There you go. Fantastic. Coming up later on, we have Ms. Kelly Clark will be joining us from Willamette Week. That'll be here in just a short while. Also, the top five, we have your Hick Watch and Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. This, however, is Dawn Taylor.
A typical school board meeting where the discussion was to be about lice instead turned into a real-life shootout. Panama City, Florida Chief of Police Robert Colbert says what ammunition the man was packing when he entered the room.
Which cut is this?
Four.
Shooting four.
Smith & Wesson 9mm high capacity. I believe it had a capability of 12 rounds. He had an extra magazine that was fully loaded in his back pocket at the time of the shooting. And then he had another box of ammo, and I believe that box of ammo was full and contained 50 rounds.
By the way, I have to say that let's see if I have these cuts for comparison. Our listener John noted that if you listen to this guy, who is a
Mike shoots him twice before he finally turns around, and Mike, I'm telling you, Mike saved our lives.
It's now, kind of almost a Huell Hauser thing going on.
You know who else he sounds like?
A broadsword, a three-piece dive show, high-end fixed blades. No,
forget all those, even
when
though those are
you can get all that, and your wildlife.
Forget all those. Look at the meat in the center shield.
Exactly.
That's where the deal is. That's why this one has taken it to a level unseen in the past.
Do you watch The Knife Guy?
I don't.
Oh, The Knife Guy's awesome.
I am familiar with The Knife Guy, but I don't actually watch The Knife Guy.
It's all where, and here's the moment when I realized that it wasn't just like me, it wasn't just like the audience. We were not the only ones.
On Futurama?
It was when I watched that Futurama movie, and they did, I swear to God, like a 2-minute riff on the knife guy, and it was simultaneously riffing on a scene from Lord of the Rings, and that's when I realized that there was a lot of genius going on there. Before we continue with this story, I should say that in just one moment we will be joined by Kelly Clark. So I'm going to Kelly Clark is going to be standing by. She will be on the program here in a second to talk about the new issue of Willamette, which the cover story is all about. So Aaron Mesh wrote a huge piece about food carts and how. While that is, it's a burgeoning part of the Portland economy. I guess they're, I guess that is a more money, more problems kind of a thing. So now there's all kinds of like weirdness and complications, and I guess Randy Leonard is, I don't know, he's doing something that is, I don't know, meddlesome or annoying or irritating.
Well, that is his way.
Yeah, so I guess those guys are starting to take it in the shorts a little bit. So we'll find out more in just a second. Let's finish out this story about the Florida shooting.
Okay, Police Chief Colbert says the man was a Facebook user. And that, in his opinion, had issues.
Did he also have Nazi imagery on his body, Don?
He had issues. Right.
I know that he had some postings on his Facebook site for V for Vendetta, and obviously the V that was spray painted at the scene. I think it's just safe to say at this point that obviously Mr. Duke had some mental health issues that he was addressing.
Now, in V for Vendetta, is it the V inside a circle, like an upside-down anarchy thing?
Yeah.
I guess it would have to be, because then otherwise you're just telling people that lizards are coming
right.
for us. All right. I'll find that video, by the way, and I'll upload it so you can watch it. It's awesome. The rest of it is just anticlimactic because you know that he isn't able to shoot anybody correctly, not even himself, for quite some time. It's just worth it all to watch the spray painting of the V.
Would you play once again the witnesses who say they were processing their close call? That would be shooting two.
Yes.
Not a pansy, but I will tell you, I was very afraid.
I didn't appreciate how close some of the bullets came to me.
You felt helpless. He was helpless out there.
What What is up with that third guy? What is it?
Helpless.
What's going on with his mouth? Let's just hear this one more time before we.
I'm not a pansy, but I will tell you, I was very afraid.
I didn't appreciate how close some of the bullets came to me.
You felt helpless. He was helpless out there.
He had a mouthful of fur. What is going? It's like I wouldn't even know how to phonetically render what it is he's speaking. Thank you. All right, thanks. I appreciate that.
A broadsword, a three-piece dice show, high-end fixed blades.
Forget all those.
You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. The great thing about the knife guy too is how he's always selling knives in sets of like 195. You know what I mean? So, like, if you absolutely require, like, a gross of hunting blades, you know, for you and...
And who doesn't?
Your loved ones. I mean, and I guess you can argue that maybe some of those are going to, you know, shops or stores or whatever. But if that were the case, they wouldn't just be advertising it on television. There'd be, like, a direct mail or there'd be, like, a trade magazine or a website or something for those places. The fact that they are putting it, like, on QVC late at night indicates that there is somebody, probably many somebodies, sitting at home and they decide that they need, like, 300 paring blades. Just sitting around.
Well, you never know when you might, like, stab a guy and not get your knife back.
That's true.
And you want extra knives.
No, that's true. I guess that's the case.
Or you bears. Know. You might go out and, like, stab bears, and then you'd be afraid to get your knife back. But now you've got, like, 194 left at home.
If you're going to be in some sort of gripping face-off with both Don Johnson and Steven Seagal, you want to be prepared, you and your compadres.
Yes.
Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program from Willamette Week, arts and culture editor and stylish woman about town, Ms. Kelly Clark. Hello there, Kelly. How are you?
Hello, you two.
do you watch The Knife Guy late at night on QVC?
No, I don't watch anything on QVC. I try really hard to spend my time watching reruns of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and other quality pieces of programming.
I can get with the Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing. I'm saying, though, you're missing out. Some of the best entertainment and really some of the best put-together fun in this world is to be found on QVC, especially late at night.
I'm telling you, Quacker Factory. You ever get a chance to watch Quacker Factory? It's this woman who makes these sweaters that have, like, ducks all over them and stuff, and she's just awesome.
Also,
okay, you guys convinced me. Knife Guy, Quacker Factory, I can make this happen.
Also, there's this show that's on Wednesdays and Sundays. It's called In the Kitchen with David, where there's this guy who just it's a guy who goes into these sort of like almost like coital expressions of bliss every time that he has like a bowl of macaroni or something.
I know who you're talking about. He's got the dark hair and he's just like really intense about the cooking things.
He sort of looks like Byron Beck if Byron were a lot taller.
Yeah.
If you were to just sort of stretch him out and make him a lot taller.
Oh,
kind of
no.
Looks like that. There's a woman. The other great thing about QVC is just seeing, it's like listening to people call up And to talk about something that is unbelievably overpriced that they have purchased that they clearly don't regret at all, like it was a turning point in their life when they bought four carameled apples for $36, which I am not even making up. That is, in fact, a thing they were selling earlier this week on QVC. I swear to Christ. And they weren't like cancer-curing apples or like they weren't golden apples that the White Witch handed to Edmund. They're just apples that are covered in caramel. Four of them, $36. Woman, she called up and it was like she was just in the most ebullient state of enthusiasm about these. It was like they had allowed her to communicate with dead loved ones or something. They were just so it really you got to watch it. I can't oversell this enough.
I can't believe that I've been missing out about this. Thank you. This is like an early Christmas present from you too. This is exciting.
Also, my
I had no idea that I was missing out on so much.
No, it's great. Also, occasionally you get to see Rod Stewart on there, who's just become like a wrinkled, like bony husk of himself, sort of pitching his Rod Stewart Sings the Classics from the American Songbook albums.
And Rhonda Shear, who used to be the hostess of Up All Night on...
I'm sorry, Dawn of what?
All night. On USA Network has her own line of bras.
See, that's the thing.
And she sells them on QVC.
I bet there's a website for that, though, and I bet those videos have been uploaded.
Probably.
All right. I'll check those out later. And this is all true. Hey, what is your favorite season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Is it two or three?
You know, actually, I'm on season two right now. Somehow, in the fact that I don't know what happened to my life, I have never seen it until this year. And so I'm on season two right now.
Well, see, but I have to say, though.
So right now, my favorite season is season two.
Well,
how about that?
And I will tell you, and I will not spoil anything or give anything away, obviously. Rick Emerson is not that guy. Dawn will give her assessment here in a second. But I got to say, for me, many people believe, now I'm not one of them, but many people believe that Buffy should have been, like, retired and vacuum sealed after season two because it was just so flawlessly done and so well executed. And for me, I'm saying if I had to pick a Buffy season, it's season three. I think season three hands down, it's my favorite season, and it's got some of my favorite episodes. Season two, though, it's really close. I mean, it's Dawn?
Yeah. I will go with season three. I'm actually a season three fan.
Season three? Well, that's good because that means I've got a whole other season to go. It's one of those things that I was at college at the time, you know, when it premiered and was busy doing other things that didn't involve TV. And so I really love a show that embraces its own campiness. It's got those good twists to it. I'm totally enjoying it. So no, I also enjoy telling people that I'm watching it and watching their faces because, you know, you can kind of judge what kind of people they are.
But
the response you get back.
When I hear that somebody is watching Buffy for the first time, it's like when somebody's going to watch, you know, The Wire or something. You know, it's like you just sort of you envy their experience of seeing it for the first time with really no, you know, or very little knowledge of it. You're jealous of that.
Yeah, and I was talking, it was funny because I was looking on Netflix and it was like, you know, it'll tell you why they're requesting, you know, why they're suggesting something for you. And it's like, we suggest Buffy the Vampire Slayer season two for you because you like 30 Rock and Battleship Galactica. And I was like, my God, is that not the most perfect mix of two things?
Well, I mean,
and then I was like, I was just like, thank you, Netflix, you're right. This is why I like this show.
And the last thing I'll say about this too is that, because otherwise we can just nerd out about Buffy like forever and ever. But I mean, really, the great thing about Buffy and about Joss Whedon's writing is that as snarky and as reflexively self-referential as that show can sometimes be, and as you say, it embraces its own campiness. But here's the thing about Joss Whedon, and maybe I don't know how far along you are, but you will realize
I'm only halfway through season two, so don't ruin things for me.
I will not. No, I won't ruin anything. I'm just going to say the thing about Whedon is that he when you least expect it, and really it isn't when you almost never see it coming, especially in the first few seasons of Buffy, where he will just sneak up behind you and hit you with like pathos or poignancy or sadness. And it's like he's just shiving you between the third and fourth ribs in the lunch line at Quantico, yeah. You know, or whatever, you know, at Sing Sing. You're never really going to see it coming.
Is there a lot of shiving?
I think
at
you've
Quantico?
Totally nailed it.
it's a demonstrative shiving. New issue of Willamette is out now, and the cover story by our good friend Aaron Mesh is all about food carts. And we were just talking about this early on because our friends Lisa and Brian Wood of Big Ass Sandwiches, they are headed toward their first anniversary of running their food cart. And
they are doing so great. Awesome people, yes.
And they really have just, you know, but they – I'm not going to say things have gone badly. They haven't, but they've certainly hit a lot of rough patches that maybe they didn't necessarily expect. And it sounds like from the article, which I haven't had a chance to read yet, but it sounds like there's a lot of complications coming, some for the first time that people didn't really expect, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's put it that way. In 2001, there were 175 food carts in Portland. They were downtown. There were some Thai carts. There were hot dog carts or pretzel carts and stuff, and that's about it. We have 609 now.
Wow.
And 175 of them have opened within the last calendar year. I mean, a boom is not even the right word. Like, it's just cataclysmic explosion. A splooshing of food carts has happened in this town. You've got a lot of worthy – I mean, anybody who's heard me blurb a lot about food carts forever, they're kind of my favorite thing in the entire universe. But that said, you've got a ton of carts all vying for the same mouths and stomachs in Portland, and they're attracting the attention of the city at this point, and rules and regulations are starting to come down, and rules and regulations on something that has really never been regulated before.
So what kind of – because I'm assuming this isn't like food safety laws or something. So what sort of rules are kicking in right now?
No, oddly enough, people who are anti-cart, which, you know, I think we've shunned most of those people and run them out of Portland at this point, you know, food safety is not an issue at all. I think it was something insane, like low, like two of the food safety complaints – that were warranted in town in the last year were about food carts. Everything else was regular brick-and-mortar restaurants. So it's not that. Right now, the big thing that's happening is Randy Leonard is cracking down on the construction that's happening. A lot of the cart pods downtown, they're building little decks and little seating areas and lean-tos so you don't get wet when it's rainy, and essentially creating an outdoor, you know, little cafe seating area for their carts. They're essentially turning themselves into illegal restaurants. And this is something that really hadn't been happening as much. Randy is cracking down on the fact that this is illegal, that they are building structures around propane gas tanks, which he says pretty much leads to, I mean, if something goes wrong, it's not just like they're going to have a fire, they're going to have rockets going off.
Yeah.
And all of the propane tanks are right next to the other propane tanks. So just imagine, like, Die Hard on Southwest Alder, basically.
It's like Die Hard in a food cart, Morty. You're going to love
pretty
it. It's
much.
Great.
Yeah.
Just as a side issue here, I feel obliged to ask, do we know exactly what, if anything, Randy Leonard said about the squalling girl whose lemonade stand was shut down earlier this year and who then was given an exemption in what I believe is a violation of the law?
Yeah, I don't think he's commented on that at all.
Right.
I don't know.
I'm just saying, so, we do seem to pick and choose where we enforce these things.
And the thing about this, though, is that what Randy Leonard says, and he was, you know, he's all through this piece. He said that more than a month ago, he went to Greg Goodman, who owns two or three of the lots downtown, major, you know, landowner here in town, land baron, and was like, hey, you better watch out for your carts. They're building all these structures. The illegal, somebody's going to get hurt. You know, tell him not to build them anymore, and gave an informal warning, basically. Well, Greg Goodman says, you know, he told them, the cart owners say, nobody ever told us jack, you know, back and forth. They're building all of these structures. I mean, we're talking about, they have built structures like it's a lean-to in front of a cart that actually is built around an existing tree. I mean, these are they are amazing construction projects. If you go online, you can see these on our site. I mean, they're awesome. Like, you look at it, you're like, I really want a burrito, and also I want to thank these people for building around the tree. There's a marble countertop that's actually around another tree. Like, it's crazy. I mean, they're very ingenious. But they haven't been permitted by the city. They haven't been vetted by anything. They are illegal. And these cart owners have spent like $2,000, $3,000 constructing them. And they say that the management of the parking lots told them that it was okay to go ahead and build these.
And
the
parking
lot managers say, we said no such thing, blah, 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 back and forth. So that's only part of it, though. I mean, the bigger issue really is it's winter. It's rainy and cold and ugly. And it's going to work if you want to go to a cart for lunch downtown and run and get some food and then take it back to your desk. But there has been a huge migration of carts to the east side and to North Portland in the last year. And all of these cart pods have popped up. And they all were doing great during the summer where people want to run around and hang out. But now that it's winter, they used to be making $800 a week, and they're making, you know, I mean, $800 a day, and now they're making like $400 a week.
Well, you know, Lauren, I went to Potato Champion a while back, and then we also, this is just a few weeks ago, and then there's the one on Belmont by Movie Madness, like 43rd
or
something.
Yeah, that's good food here. Yeah, that's one that's having some problems now. That's good food here.
And that was, we went there, and you know, and again, the food is great, but it's like we were actually not going to Movie Madness. We were going to someplace in the neighborhood, and so we'd park the car. And it's that thing of like getting the food and walking back to our car. And now, granted, we had gotten out of the car, walked there, got the food, walked back. And so we did spend money there, but it was actually so bad and so cold outside that the entire trip back to the car just seemed very, very miserable. And it was overall, the experience was such that we probably now I feel like a dick for saying this, but I was thinking like, well, let's come back here when it's a little bit warmer, which probably a lot of people have that same, you know, it's a summertime business to some degree.
Exactly. And what's happened is that a lot of business, you know, a lot of property owners who in a different kind of economy would have built on their property instead are renting it out piecemeal to carts and saying, I'm going to start a new park, a cart pod. I'm going to give you some tenting and shelter and some heat lamps, and we're going to have a big cart pod. Well, the problem is the more carts they pack on their lot, the more rent they get. And they're charging around, you know, $400-$500 a cart. Well, when you have next to no foot traffic,
right,
you can't really support 18 carts. Now, Hawthorne Pod, where Cartopia, where a Potato Champion is, and Whiffy's Fried Pies, they have the cart owners themselves have been very clear with the pod owners that they can't really support more than 8 or 9 carts.
Right.
So that's actually why they've kept their numbers down, and it's worked for them. That's why they're still kind of successful, is that they know that they can't support any more people. They can't support any more businesses. But a lot of the Eastside cart pods were not built from the ground up. They were built by property owners going, oh, I bet, okay, I can make some rent off of property that I can't really do anything else with. Just pack them all on there. And these carts were doing fine in the summer. This is their first summer they've been open. They were really gratified by all the crowds coming. And now it's winter, and they're not seeing anybody out there.
What?
And we're talking places that serve great food. Creme de la Creme, which is a French cart that serves some of the best French dip in town that's at Good Food here. I mean, she's getting nothing now. She was the one who was making $800 a day and is now making less than $800 a week.
So two questions. One is sort of subjective, so I'll get to that one in a second. But in the overview here of Aaron Mesher's piece, which, again, everybody, if you're hearing this, you can read it in the new issue of Willamette Week. This is Wednesday, December 15th, the new issue of Willamette. He mentioned something about the Oregon Restaurant Association either filing or threatening a lot of these carts with lawsuits. What's going on there?
It's just talk at this point. There's nothing more than this. But basically, you know, it's always kind of been one of those things, oh, the restaurants don't like the food carts, and it was kind of grumbling, but you could never figure out whether it was really true or not. Restaurants are pissed. They see carts as basically sidestepping all of the things that restaurants have to deal with. They're getting the best deal out of anyone in town. The reason is that even though to get a mobile license, a mobile cart license and a restaurant license is about the same amount of money, I think it's like $300, the restaurants have to pay thousands of dollars in system development fees to the city, to the county, to sewer. If there is a name, if there is a bureau with label, you know, with initials in this town, restaurants are shelling out for it. And so basically they see carts as these usurpers who they don't pay any of these fees. They're building decks and making themselves into mini illegal restaurants and not paying their fair share. Mm. And so in a lot of ways, I mean, the Restaurant Association is furious over carts because they think if you're a cart, you ought to be mobile, you ought to be small, you ought to move around, and you should not be a sit-down restaurant. So, you know, there's some valid, you know, points to what they're arguing. And the head of the Restaurant Association, when he was talking to Aaron, did say the word lawsuit. He was like, you know, what's going to happen when there's a local sandwich shop that's a brick-and-mortar building and then another, you know, a cart opens up next to it and they sell the same thing and, you know, the restaurant realizes that they're essentially, you know, taking away their business and they have all these fees coming due to the city. They're going to refuse to pay them and there's going to be a big woolly lawsuit on your hands. So it's not necessarily – no one's doing it yet, but we wouldn't be surprised if it happened. Restaurants are really – I mean, they're angry because they're saying it's a tough economy for them as well. Why are they taking all this burden when there's basically a shadow economy of secondary restaurants that's not paying their fair share? On the other hand, the cart owners rightfully say they can't afford to rent a brick-and-mortar restaurant to pay all of these fees. If they're going to share their food with people in town and make any sort of start – they've got to do it for an entry fee that they can pay, which means they're going to have a food cart.
There's so much that we could do another hour just talking about this. But I'll ask you a question, and I hate to even ask because I feel like I'm putting, to use a word from last hour, I feel like I'm putting the bad juju in the air by even using this. But just from what you have seen in your assessment of the lay of the land, Portland-wise, with the food carts and what Aaron has reported in this story. you know, the economy still sucks for most people, and the recession is obviously still going on, regardless of what various factions of the government say. In your opinion, are we going to see within like the next year some sort of a microcosmic recurrence of the national recession just in the food cart economy, where it's like a foreclosing kind of a thing, where you get 30% of the people out there who put their savings on the line to do this, all of this stuff comes out of the woodwork and bites them in the ass, and then they go under?
You know, that's already happening. So it's not one of those things like it's a terrifying prospect that we're worried that the cart economy is shaky and all these people are going to go under. Carts are always going under, and new carts are always opening. People are always figuring out that they're not nearly making the amount of money they need to be a sustainable business. A lot of people are lured into carts because of the low entry, and then, you know, there's no barrier practically to entry to open a cart. And then they find out that it's not worth the money, the man hours that they're putting into it. I mean, it's far more than they would at any other business, and they quit. So, yes, I think that if the regulations go through, not only is Randy pushing for regulations, some that are warranted because of the diehard rocket, you know, scenario, obviously, some that are a little iffy, you know, a lot of other, you know, city and county agencies are also thinking about, you know, revisiting their laws for mobile food carts, because all their laws are from like the 70s and 80s when they're talking about a pretzel cart. So all of that's going to come down, and that may affect some cart owners. But the majority of the stuff that's going to affect them is just all of this proliferation of these pods. It's going to be a thing where people are going to figure out whether they can still make money with the amount of carts that are around them and the amount of foot traffic they have. The good thing about a cart is if you're renting a brick-and-mortar space and nobody's walking by you and nobody's going to you, you're kind of stuck. If you're a cart, you can still move. You can move downtown.
Right.
You can move to a different area where there are people. So carts have a lot more options and flexibility to survive. Also, if you sell something that tastes really, really great, people will remember you, they will follow you, and they will try. You know, Portland loves an underdog. That's why they love their food carts. You know, they're great food in a really non-fussy setting, and those underdogs are going to be supported. So when it's like, when you talk about like it's 30%, are they going to all, you know, go away and all crash and burn? No. It'll be less than that. It's going to happen, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And also, it's already happening, and it's been continuously happening the entire time that we've gained all these carts.
The new issue is on stand now. Willamette Week, the new Willamette Week issue is out now with Aaron Mesh's cover story about food carts. You can also read it online at WWeek.com. As you finish each season of Buffy, you should stop and do just like a gut check on whether or not you would like to have that experience sullied as you get further and further into the series. Or perhaps just check in with Dawn and myself or other people who have watched the show a few times and just maybe get an assessment, maybe take a vote of your geek friends about whether or not you ought to continue after each season concludes.
I heard I should stop after maybe season 3 or 4. So that's what I was told.
It's a point of diminishing returns is the thing. You still get great episodes.
I feel that way about Battlestar. Yeah, I feel that way about a lot of shows, aside from The Wire, which I don't. Like, The Wire pretty much is perfect the way it is. But, I mean, a lot of shows have that high point. I will check in with both of you before
awesome.
I do this. This is a decision every woman has to make for herself, but I'm glad that I have your help
awesome.
On this pressing issue of Buffy.
Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. The new issue on stands now or online at WWeek.com. Thank you, Kelly. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
There you go. That's Kelly Clark, ladies and gentlemen. All right. We should take a pee break, don't you think?
I think so.
A break for things.
Sure.
And whatnot. All right. You know, and also the peeing and so forth. It is the Rick Emerson radio program, a glorious food cart of radio.
And pee.
Mostly the radio part. Thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday, December 15th, 2010. Still to come, we have your top five songs with sick in the title. Also, your Hick Watch. We got your Joy of Christmas coming up.
Although I realize the Hick Watch is actually a Christmas watch as well.
Really?
So it's kind of a combination.
So we can just fold one into the other.
Right. We can just do just some. It'll just be one giant Christmas thing.
Awesome. Even more efficient than we normally are. So this is all on the way, and it is all brought to you by a litany, a series, a gaggle, a murder of fine business partners, including Sorrell's Vintages. That's at the, not at the intersection of it, but it is directly across the street from the Baghdad and next to Powell's Books on Hawthorne. It's at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. 3713 13 Southeast Hawthorne. And I do believe sometime within the next, maybe this week, it may not. It may be tomorrow, but if not tomorrow, it may actually be early next week that Daniel from Sorrell's is actually going to come in and he's going to talk to us. He's going to bring in a few specific items. Because here's the thing. It's like on the one side, there's the vintage stuff, which is, you know, furniture from, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And that is all, you know, it's not reproductions. It's not duplicates. It's not like there's some, the group of underfed Salvadoran school children having to pound it together in a warehouse somewhere and ship it overseas. I mean, it's all like the authentic furniture from that time. It's all one of a kind because they, go throughout the region. They go to other stores, to estate sales, to whatever, and they pick and choose things and they bring them back. So that is all there. It's beautiful. But once they sell it, it's gone. The other side of the store, you know, they got a lot of, you know, a bunch of smaller things, a sort of giftorial garnish that goes with the larger items. And it's like I just never know. Everything goes back to House now because I'm watching House, so it's like there's a quote for all occasions there. But it's the thing where he says that, you know, that there's nothing worse than just putting somebody in the wrong mental box by giving them a gift that doesn't quite fit. Mm. And it's the thing where you look at it and you go, I just have no idea which of these things, you know. And so it helps to have a guy who kind of knows, you know, he knows what people are looking for and he knows what kind of person comes in to shop for what item.
He's like a magical Christmas elf who will help you choose your gifts.
Or like a less murderous Jason Robards from Needful Things.
Yeah.
He's
awesome.
Exactly,
yes.
Like that. You will like Daniel. He's a he is a great guy. I mean, he really, and as I think I've mentioned, he's a guy who just exudes like this effortless, relaxed kind of style. Or you want to hire him just to sort of like just to fix your entire life and just to make you more presentable in every way. So, have you gone to Sorrell's? Have you had a chance?
I have not yet.
What's going on in your life that could possibly be so important, Don?
Nothing really. I got nothing going on.
Patrick's bed have wheels on it.
I'm just eating bonbons and and catching up on Sons of Anarchy. I should be shopping.
Slacking is what you're doing. You should be spending money hand over fist. Come on.
The economy is in trouble because of me.
That's right, Don. It really is. It really is your fault. When you do carve some time out of your busy, precious schedule. Away from your poor husband with his missing gallbladder and his holes in his stomach, you will find that when you go to Sorrell's, the store, as we often say, you are going to look at it and you're going to look at the things. You're going to see the items, both the new and the vintage, and then you're going to look at the price and there's going to be a little bit of a you're going to have a little bit of a cerebral dissonance there. You're going to have a little
McRib is back moment.
That's right. You're going to have a little bit of you're going to be at a strange cognitive juncture where you are going to realize that things are much less expensive than they look. They look fantastic. They look beautiful. And you know what? They're going to look even more so when you look at the price and you find that it's much lower than you anticipated. So find out more by going to their store. That is Sorrell's Vintages, 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, a proud sponsor of this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We return next with more, including your top five and your joy of Christmas. You stay there. This is the Rick Emerson Show.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Happy holiday, happy holiday. May the calendar keep bringing happy holidays to you.
If you're burdened down with trouble, if your nerves are wearing thin, pack your load down the road, come to holiday.
traffic noise affects you like a squeaky violin. Take your cares down the stairs, out of the Holiday Inn.
Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. Did you see lightning? I guess not, because because you're in a black room and the curtains are all drawn and you don't have access to a window.
Yes. which makes me wonder how you saw lightning.
Well, just moments ago, I was actually opening the curtains to look outside because I just heard this. I heard a furious rain beating going on. It was a bluster. It sounded like a blustery day. So I opened it, and sure enough, and here's the thing. Like, I don't really care. I mean, rain is fine with me. Doesn't matter. But it does seem. Normally, rain gets that kind of, like, ongoing drizzle that lasts forever.
Yes.
But we do seem to be getting a lot of the pounding rain recently. So I was just opening the curtains to look at. Hey, what's the difference between curtains and drapes? Same thing?
I think they're the same thing, yeah.
No difference?
I don't know.
Okay. So anyway, I was just pulling aside the coverings on the windows to look outside. And then I just saw that bright flash just out of my... Which means one of two things. Either it's lightning or you've just been hit by one of those automated speed cameras. And since I'm just sitting immobile, sedentary, in my chair... It seems unlikely that I've been hit by the man.
Or you have some kind of a tumor. And you're seeing bright flashes of light that don't actually exist.
That's also possible. Speaking of which, can I just tell you this? Not so much the tumor, but on the other thing. So yesterday when I was leaving, I shouldn't even say this. I shouldn't even be committing this to public record. Yesterday when I was driving in a given area of our fair city, I swear to God, I think I got hit by one of the not even a traffic light camera. It was just like at a like one of those like vans that sits by the side of the road where the man just lurks inside like some sort of a an ovarian cyst, and then hits you with the radar gun as you go by, and then you see the flash, and then you get the thing in the mail 2 weeks later saying you've been speeding, which I will deny, by the way, because I wasn't speeding, and no, I wasn't even in the car. I was dead at the time. I wasn't even – there's – you because there's that thing.
It's,
you know,
my evil twin.
Well, it's like, you know, it's the photograph of you going by, and it's like, you know, in the best case scenario, you hope that either the license plate or you is a little blurred out in the photograph so that you can say, not my car. Guy that looks like me, not my car. Look, you can't even make out the license plate number. Or if you can make out the license plate number, you can blame it on you like your deadbeat cousin Brad.
See, if they couldn't make out the license plate number, how would they know who to send the ticket to?
Well, see, because the cop will sometimes write it down. That's the thing. The cop will send it down, but write it down because they'll flag all of those things, and then they'll send you the ticket, thinking that you will probably just give up the loot. So it's all as with you know this. It's as with most things. It's whether or not you feel like going in and arguing about it. It's whether you want to go in and fight
it. And you always want to go in and argue about it.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, Don. Or were you being sarcastic?
No.
Oh, no. I always go in because here's the thing. Just by showing up, you can get the thing kicked down like 50% most of the time. But, you know, it's like if I'm a little blurry, then I can always just say that it's like some guy. And even though my name is on the registration, you know, technically the ticket is mine, if I can make a convincing case that it was like some scallywag relative of mine, then often you can get a lower, you know, like a more than 50% reduction in my experience.
But that would be lying.
Is it?
Well,
says you. How do you know? Were you there?
You just said that you were there and you saw it happen and you know that it happened.
I was there in the car as my deadbeat relative was driving. Hello. Have I said at any point in this conversation that I was driving?
What if in the in the picture, what if there's no one in the passenger seat?
Well, I was ducking down to get something off the floor. Mm. Not drugs either. It was something completely legitimate.
You know that it's not true.
Well, that doesn't matter. It's Don, it's not
you know in your heart.
Don, here's a little life truth you need to know. It's not about what you know. It's about what you can prove. That's the way that things are. There's what you think, there's what you know, and there's what you can demonstrate to be true. And the man only cares about the last of those things. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk, ladies and gentlemen.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Time magazine has named Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg its Person of the Year. Mark Zuckerberg joined the ranks of winners that include heads of state and rock stars. At 26, Zuckerberg is the youngest person of the year since the first one chosen, Charles Lindbergh, who was 25 when he was named in 1927. Zuckerberg beat out Britain's Queen Elizabeth II by just 2 weeks. She was 26 when she was named person of the year in 1952.
He beat her out by what?
2 weeks.
Oh, not for this year, though.
No.
Okay, so I was going to say, like, what the hell would that just make
no,
any sense?
No, by age.
All right, okay.
In
so
age.
Being the youngest person. All right.
The person of the year is the person or thing that has most influenced the culture and the news during the past year, for good or for ill. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke received the honor last year. The 2008 winner was then-President-elect Barack Obama. The 2007 winner was Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Other previous winners have included Bono, President George W. Bush, and Amazon.com CEO and founder Jeff Bezos.
Who was it last year, does it say?
Bernanke.
Okay, so he was for 2000. It's right. One of those things that, like, everybody cares about for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then, like, the next day, you couldn't, for the life of you, come up with who exactly it was.
Lev Grossman, who wrote the story for Time, says that the new movie's The Social Network does not accurately portray Zuckerberg's personality.
Which cut is this?
Zuckerberg 1.
Let's see if I can... I'm busy.
With Mark, but...
I'm sorry, I'll try that one more time.
With Mark, but he's a friendly, warm person. He's not somebody who is alienated the way that character in the movie was.
He doesn't really seem like a friendly, warm person. I mean, just like, it's not like I know him, you know, like we're intimate buddies or something. But you watch him do his public presentations, and maybe it's not that he's not friendly and warm. He does seem to have like an Asperger's kind of a thing going on. And I'm not talking about like the what's-his-name's portrayal of him. I mean, like if you,
No, yeah. If you see footage of him talking to assembled crowds and such.
And he's got that Gates thing going on, too, where if you watch him for a long period of time, like occasionally it looks like he just starts sort of rocking back in place like some sort of weird techie weeble, and which is kind of unnerving because they say when Gates does that, it's like when Gates starts thinking when he starts thinking in a very focused fashion to himself, he starts rocking back and forth, and they said that the outcome of that is one of two things. He's either going to come up with some brilliant idea or solution to some nagging problem, or he's just going to explode in a torrent of profanity and firings. And so it's like the rocking back and forth is just like the slow tick down of a bomb.
Oh, God. Gerstmann disputes some people's claims that Zuckerberg is simply an accidental billionaire.
Speak now!
He is a smart guy, and he has vision as well. Very early on, I think he had a sense of the kind of change he wanted to make in the world. I think he hoped that Facebook would get as big as it did. He didn't know that it would, but he hoped it would, and that was his vision.
This guy doesn't really sound like he knows what he's talking about. I dispute that he is in any way an authority on Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, sometimes writers are better at the whole writing than
yeah.
they are at the
I mean,
talking.
Just hire somebody to go out and speak for you. That's what somebody should do. You know, somebody should offer to be a proxy public speaker for writers and for other people who don't really communicate well, like in person, face to face, or, you know, in dealing with crowds, but who are not well known enough that the ruse would be discovered. Like, you know, Stephen King, he's a bad example because he speaks well. But, you know, there are certain writers who are famous enough that the people would obviously be able to suss out that they were just being swindled. This is where you'd send the proxy out for some writer that it's like everybody reads his stuff, but nobody knows what he looks like.
Yeah. That would work.
That's a thing that somebody ought to do. So right now, I'm saying in this weird hodgepodge of an economy, there are still jobs to be had. That's one.
You could do this. You could hire yourself out as a writer's
yeah,
proxy.
So whenever they want like that, I don't know, who's the Gravity's Rainbow guy that nobody's
Thomas
allowed to
Pynchon.
Talk to? Whatever. Yeah, so they just send him out, you know, instead of having to do the whole like, and, you know, during the course of this interview on CNN, you know, which he has been one of the people who's walked by the camera or something, or Thomas Harris or some crap.
Yeah. For a long time, I had this super secret personal theory that Thomas Pynchon was actually Tom Robbins, that they were the same guy.
That's interesting. Why would you have?
There are certain similarities in their writing styles. They're about the same age. When you see a picture of there's only one or two pictures of Thomas Pynchon when he was a younger man. He looks similar to Robbins. They both come from like the same. I think they went to the same college.
Does Tom Robbins still write books?
I have this nagging sense that he may have died. Actually, I'm not sure.
How sad.
And then I feel sad because that I don't know for sure.
But maybe it's just like a really slow output for him.
The last couple of books he wrote were kind of awful.
Yeah. No. They talk about Tom Robbins the way they sort of talk about. I've heard him described as being just like Ken Kesey. Except that Kesey had the sense to stop writing when he was no longer really able to write, and that Robbins just sort of like plunged on ahead, like unaware of his own inability to keep doing it.
Yeah, and Tom Robbins to me is that sort of authorial equivalent of like say Tim Burton, where I loved him so much for his early work, and that so now something new comes out and I go, Tim Burton or Tom Robbins, and then I go, oh yeah, that's
yeah.
right, he sucks now.
Yeah. And then it's like experiencing a little personal personal pain all over again
yeah.
for the first time.
Let's start diving into our joy of Christmas.
Let's.
We have a lot of Christmas.
We should say first and foremost before we do anything else, your joy of Christmas today, whether they want to or not, they're bringing it to you. They are ChristmasMountainTrees.com. They are the sponsors of today's installment of Joy of Christmas, which, by the way, is going to feature. So I just printed out that. Did I hand that to you?
You did indeed.
The third piece. All right. There's a lot to get to. I mean, I just sifting through because I have Christmas set as one of my Google alerts. Christmas and Xmas. And then I have, and you probably do this as well, like with nail gun and so forth. Do you put combinations of words as Google alerts?
I haven't because I already get so much mail from the Google alerts as it is that I started kind of winnowing them down a bit.
What alerts do you have for this show?
I've got taser, I've got tased, I have nail gun, wood chipper, corpse cannibal, Dick Cheney, Britney Spears. One that I also have that I get a lot of good stuff from is horrified.
Yeah.
If a story has some quote in it about how someone was horrified, that usually comes up. There's usually something good there.
You can also, I have a Google search phrase, alcohol was believed to be a factor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just alcohol. And then, like, accident or I have the police believe that the victim. That's another thing that'll get you a lot of results. I have Christmas, I have Xmas, and then I have like Christmas and killed, and then I have Christmas and stolen, and then I have one that's just Christmas, Xmas, fire. Which just, I mean, really, as I said earlier, I woke up this morning, there was just 9 different stories waiting for me. And then you found like 2 more. So it's just really, it's a bumper crop of holiday horror that we'll get to in a second. So you can remove yourself from this sphere of the holiday season by ensuring a fantastic Christmas tree, which will grace your home and bring the spirit of the season, into your place of residence in the most wondrous and non-horrifying, non-fiery way possible. Go to Christmas Mountain Trees. Their website is christmasmountaintrees.com. And by the way, if you went to if you see my Facebook page over the last couple of days, our listener Kara, a longtime P1, she went to Christmas Mountain Trees, and the way that I know this is that she actually took a picture of her pug, her dog, who I believe is wearing a cape of some kind. And I mean, she said that the dog was just sort of exhausted and his will had been broken by that point in the day, but I think he's just much better behaved than either of my dogs. But he's wearing some sort of a cape or a cloak or some sort of a ceremonial sash of some kind. But he's right on the ground in front of the sign that says Christmas Mountain Trees. Aww. So it really it's awesome. You can see it on my Facebook page. You go up there and it's so often people use that phrase, it's an experience the entire family will love. And I think it's almost always a lie. That's the thing, is it's never true.
Yeah.
There's always just some there's some aspect to it, there's some member of your family where it's just not going to jibe. Now, if your family's into Christmas and if you got kids, Doesn't matter what else it goes on with their personality, good, bad, or indifferent. What other factors may come into play in terms of what they enjoy or don't? Because kids can be mercurial in that way. Children love Christmas, and even the hardest of adult hearts can be softened by the holiday spirit. Isn't that right, Don Taylor?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, honestly, it's like, say maybe you don't think trudging around and getting a Christmas tree sounds like a good idea. Well, you get up there, it's beautiful. You get to ride around on the wagony thing that takes you around. There's free coffee. I mean, come on. Free coffee is always good.
Right there. I mean, it's
a big roaring fire you can stand around drinking your... I mean, even if you were grumpy when you got there, you wouldn't be, because it's kind of awesome.
Also, here's the other great thing about this, and I'm speaking out of to the nerds in the audience. When you get to Christmas Mountain Trees, first of all, I'm telling you this, you get on the wagon, you're going to go around, and there's several different, not stands, but several different sort of orchards, probably, is the right way to put this, because there's 175 miles of trees. But, there's your noble fir, there's your Doug fir, there's your whatever, and they'll take you around to every section. You can get off, and there's always another wagon coming by. They got 3 of them. They're always going, minute to minute, there's one always leaving and one always arriving. So,
or you could be like me and you could just stay on the wagon and just keep going around and around and around while your friends are getting their trees.
And make your husband trudge out into the icy cold.
And then 2 days later,
I see.
Okay. Oh, you're not feeling bad, honey. You're feeling kind of bad.
Too bad. I don't want to stand up, Patrick. You better.
Yeah, I'm going to ride on this wagon while you got us down a tree.
I know you didn't bring a coat or anything, but.
Yeah, it's all my fault. And now he has no gallbladder.
ChristmasMountainTrees.com is the website for this. I will just say this one thing. As you are there, as you get on the wagon, which is hauled by sort of just like a tractor thing that takes you up there, they'll stop. You can spend literally, 5 minutes or 5 hours wandering around until you find exactly the right tree. You'll pick it out, and they'll take it down. And by the time you get to the bottom of the mountain, the tree's going to be there. The needles are taken off. It's baled up. It's beautiful. And while you're up there, you really do have, and I wouldn't say this if it were not that true, it is a spectacular view, because you get to see, three of the Cascades, and it's just, you can see, you can probably see for 2 states, on a clear day up there, because it's just beautiful. And then you think to yourself, well, it's just an expanse of green. How pretty can that really be? But you do not, and here's the other thing about this, and I know this makes me sound like an idiot, like a guy who doesn't understand science, but you don't really get, I think, the whole thing about how trees are producing oxygen until you're standing in the middle of 85,000 trees, and there's just, it sounds daft to say it out loud, but the air just smells different. Because you've got that Christmas. First of all, you got that Christmas tree smell like everywhere. It permeates everything. The rest of the day, I actually would occasionally just kind of go and just kind of give my coat a good sniff, and it has that Christmas tree scent like right in it, which is awesome. But you get Troy talking. Troy and Jennifer are the owners of the farm. You get him talking about the chemical process and the soil and the different sugar levels in the trees and how he's worked to raise that over the decades to make the needles stay on longer, to get the smell going. And then you go into that the covered area where there's the cider and the hot chocolate, and you see all of those insane inventions that they've got now that I never knew existed. Like, there's that whole, there's that thing that, like, you put down in the base of the tree where the water goes, and then it just, there's a little ornament on the tree that, I swear to God, it's just a red and green light that starts to blink when the water level gets low. I don't know why I didn't buy that.
I don't either.
I should have bought that, like, you know, the, when we were there a couple weeks ago. What a fool I was. So, it really, it's just a glorious experience in every way possible. Find out more by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com or Facebook.com/ChristmasMountain. They are bringing you this, the joy of Christmas, right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. There is Dawn Taylor.
Well, from the world of the Hick Watch slash Christmas Watch, we have the story from Purcell, Oklahoma. Officials with a charity in McLean County, Oklahoma, have a unique holiday problem. A skunk sprayed hundreds of presents that were going to be given to low-income families in the area. This via Peggy Christian with the McLean County Operation Christmas.
Wow.
McLean County Operation Christmas is an all-volunteer group that took care of 786 children in 2009 with expectations of providing gifts to 850 or more this year. As for the gifts that were sprayed by skunks, it's unclear whether they can be salvaged. Christian said, "The ones laying out, they've been sprayed with Febreze many, many times." Volunteers took the wrapped presents outside to air them out.
Now, were these presents, so they were wrapped, though? Although, I guess it doesn't really matter because it soaks through because it's a liquid that they spray you with.
Yeah, it is.
There's no Febreze. Here's, friends and neighbors, look, I don't want to, you know, prick anybody's balloon here. Febreze doesn't really clean things, just so you know. I don't care what the label says.
No.
I don't care what, like, the Downey Corporation has had you believe. There's nothing cleaned. But you can't put perfume on a pig and expect it to, you know, to just magically be sterile. That doesn't really work. Okay. All right.
So there you go. So there was Joy of Christmas story.
Part one.
Part one. Part two. The Grinch may have stolen Christmas, but in Birmingham, Alabama, it was copper thieves who torched a Christmas tree in downtown's Lynn Park. Birmingham police are investigating an early morning incident where copper thieves took decorations off the holiday display and then burned down the tree. Officials say the incident occurred around 4 a.m. Thieves took off the lights and used gasoline to separate the plastic from the copper, resulting in the apparent accidental tree torching. Public Works crews this morning took down the charred remains of the holiday display. The 35-foot-tall Norwegian spruce came from North Carolina and won't be replaced. Marvin Miller, City Parks and Recreation Director, said this is the first time there has been any major damage to the Christmas display. "It's not good," he said. "It kind of dampens the season, but we still know what the season is about. It's not about a tree. This is the first time this has ever happened. We'd have ornaments taken from the tree, but nothing like this."
Aren't you kind of amazed that it took this long, though, for this to happen? Because those guys, the copper thieves, you know, it's like there's some, it's like some sort of a, like a, the felonious truffle hound where they can just sense out, like they can just.
There's metal in there.
Oh, there's some aluminum. You know, and it's like they immediately just, they're able to find it. I mean, it's like, you know what we ought to do is that we ought to just start. You know, like when people go up into Mount Hood or something, or people are going like off into the woods, you know, they ought to just carry some sort of like an aluminum foil or something on them, or just carry like a tin cup. And then if they get lost, you just send in a bunch of meth heads to find them under the promise that, like, look, you can have whatever metal is on them, because they just seem to be able to root that out without any problem at all. They almost have this weird sort of like supernatural prescience for it.
Yeah, there's this problem now that guardrails are being damaged in parts, particularly in parts of, like, say, Clackamas County. Where, like, the little bridges that go across streams and stuff, people are just ripping the metal
off
the guardrails.
Out.
Yeah.
Well, this is where you realize. I mean, even if I were not already convinced that creationism is bunk, this is when you get the sense that we are just. This is why I find it so difficult to care about many news stories that involve, you know, like. Whatever it is we're doing to the environment that really is only ultimately going to kill us, because we're just big termites. I mean, that's it. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. That is, you know, science is neither good nor bad. It just exists. And, like, we are just big roaches. And the proof of that is that we behave just like big dung beetles or termites, except we're not after wood. There's a great number of us who are after
meth
or a Super Bowl championship.
Yeah. Now we have Joy of Christmas story, Trace.
Awesome.
F Off Harrods was written by a disgruntled employee across the front of Harrods department store. Gaining access to a maintenance control room, Lloyd Hudson, 35, from Essex, was able to locate the chart and corresponding switches for Harrods 10,000 external lights.
And this is Harrods in, they're in London,
right? In London.
Yeah.
Barricading himself in, Hudson disabled the correct lights until he could spell out his feelings to Harrods bosses and Christmas shoppers alike. He was removed by security guards after an hour-long standoff, then handed off to the police. And there is a photograph of this that was in the story. I don't know if we're putting this up. It does have a dirty word on it because he didn't actually spell F off. He spelled the actual word.
This will be online here in just a moment. You'll be able to see this. It really is. See, the thing is, I like guys like this that just go out with a little bit of style. You know, they a little bit of because anybody can just sort of give you the finger and walk out.
Yeah.
This actually took intelligence. It took planning.
Mm-hmm.
It took, I would imagine, a little bit of intestinal fortitude, because he could have been caught. He could have been discovered.
It also, according to a spokesperson for the store, took a couple of bottles of whiskey. He had
awesome.
drunk the best part of two bottles of whiskey, said the spokesperson, and it's that kind of behavior that got him the sack in the first place.
They're all the best parts, Don.
Honestly, I'm disgusted, said Irene Ryder, 59, from Gary, Indiana. I was with my grandchildren. We had just gotten off the bus. I said, look, everybody, and pointed up to the lights. But you know what the lights said? They said, F off. And that's not an appropriate message for a child, at least not at Christmas time.
That's right. The rest of the year, it'd be fine. Now, no, not so much. So we will have that posted here in just a skosh. You'll be able to see this, and it really is. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. It's the human spirit personified.
Mm-hmm.
They may have taken his job, but they could not take his freedom or spirit.
No, right. At Christmas time.
I imagine the cops are actually probably taking his freedom right about now. But I mean, but the rest of it, it'll remain. Yeah.
Actually, he's been released on bail, so I guess he's doing okay.
He's sort of like the guy, the Stephen, what's his name, in the plane that said like F this, and then grabbed the beer and slid down. I bet that there is some segment, some faction of London that is embracing him as a folk hero.
So, Joy of Christmas, Part the Fourth. A Belleville, Missouri. I believe this is Missouri. A Belleville, Missouri woman is in jail for selling her children's Christmas gifts to buy crack cocaine. Sandra J. Bowers, 35, is being held on $50,000 bond. Sheriff's Captain Stephen Johnson said Bowers, the mother of two young sons, stole about $1,000 worth of toys and gifts that the children's grandmother had bought last week. Bowers then sold the gifts to buy crack. The children, two boys, age 4 and 5, were staying with their grandmother, who is Bowers' mother, and she has a restraining order against Bowers. Despite the restraining order, the grandmother, Pamela Guyon, wanted Bowers to be part of the children's Christmas, so she invited her daughter to go shopping with her. That was my error, Pamela Guyon said. She has a drug habit. I tried to help her as her mother, but drugs are more important. Pamela Guyon, 57, said the restraining order was because her daughter had stolen her car, jewelry, and husband's tools in the past.
Wow.
But Guyon thought her daughter had kicked her drug habit. When I think about it, there are a lot of signs she was back on drugs, she said. Agitation, very hyper, nervousness.
Excellent.
Guyon's husband is fighting cancer and is on disability. He received his monthly disability check last week, and Guyon went shopping for the grandchildren, bought $1,000 in presents for the kids, intending to let Bowers give some of them to her two sons. On Thursday night, Bowers slept over at the grandmother's home, stole the presents, sold them for crack.
Ran away with a spoon.
Yeah.
Here's the great thing about this story is that I try to find a silver lining in everything. I try to see the half full aspect of even the most horrifically dirty and filthy and cracked glass. And with this, it just is a little bit of underscoring that, of what you and I have probably both believed for a long time, which is the idea that there ought to be some sort of eugenics is not always a bad thing. A little forced sterilization, I'm saying that could probably go a long way toward making a society, that helps you trend upward in any number of ways. So, this really it just shows that that's not such an incorrect way of thinking.
Not always.
All right, there is your four-part Joy of Christmas for Wednesday, December 15th, 2010.
So much joy.
Fantastic. So a couple more. We'll do the top five for today, and then we will make way for Sarah Axel and Greg Nibbler. They're going to be here taping funemploymentradio.com. By the way, if you want to see that Herod sign, you can do so. It's posted in the gallery at rickemerson.com/pictures. You go to rickemerson.com pictures, and you will see that in the visual aids for Wednesday, December 15th, 2010.
The 2011 inductees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame have been revealed. They include Neil Diamond, who has been eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for several years but never got a nomination, although he says he was never really worried about it. In a phone interview, he said, "I thought about it occasionally, but I kind of figured they'd get around to me at some point."
Now, I love Neil Diamond. I mean, I just not have any doubt about that. I mean, he's no Manilow, but he certainly contributed his share to the American cultural spectrum. He doesn't really seem like a rock and roll guy, though, even by the broadest possible definition. And I know there's been some debate about, there's been some debate about putting hip-hop in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or whatever, but that at least shares the same general tone, and sort of an attitudinal outlook as rock and roll, and musically there's a lot of overlap there. Neil Diamond, I question that. I have reservations about that.
Also inducted this year, and also not someone I would think of as rock and roll, even less so than Neil Diamond, Tom Waits. So I don't see how you induct Tom. I love Tom Waits, but I rock and roll, not so much.
See, I can see Tom Waits, though, because Tom Waits, because he's, again, because his demeanor and subject matter are very rock and roll. I mean, it's, you know, because he just sings about, like, booze and whores. And Neil Diamond is just talking about, it's music for ice skating rinks, essentially.
Also inducted, New Orleans musician Dr. John, Darlene Love, that's a good choice, and Alice Cooper.
Yeah, and that's the one that I actually did see. I was spoiled a little bit for this because as I was printing it out, I did see the headline that Alice Cooper was inducted, which, by the way, I didn't think would ever happen. And I think Cooper himself, not unlike, because I think Black Sabbath finally got in a year or two ago, and Ozzy had actually said, Ozzy actually sent them like a certified, like a registered sort of like F off letter where he just said, like, take our name out of contention. He's like, I don't even want to be in the ballot. F you guys, die. Just as I think Johnny Rotten had the year before, because because as Gene Simmons said that really of all the honors you could possibly receive in your life, you know, being praised by aging irrelevant baby boomers is not on the list of things that he desires. And so, you know.
Yeah, the Associated Press called Cooper and asked for his response. And he said, well, you know, it crosses your mind. But then you think of all the guys who aren't in there, some of them before you. And you go, wow, you realize it's a waiting game. I don't think you sit around holding your breath on it.
Well, you know, I mean, the fact that as I have said before many, many times, I mean, the fact that, the fact that Kiss isn't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, whatever anybody thinks about them musically, they are the most influential American rock band of all time, period. And they are the second most influential rock band in all of the world, period, second only to the Beatles. And so that right there sort of gives a lie to the whole idea that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is relevant anyway. And also Cheap Trick's not in there. So those guys can suck one, not Cheap Trick, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
So they can get seriously bent is what they can get. So, all right, F those guys.
F them.
Let's do one more, and then we will roll our top five for today. Don Taylor.
All right. A man stabbed his mother to death and gravely wounded his father Monday in their home, then fled to a nearby subway station, jumped onto the tracks, and was struck by an oncoming train. Ryan Devaney, 31, who was hospitalized in serious condition, is facing murder and attempted murder charges. His parents were found on the front porch of their Brooklyn home. Calls to possible relatives. Police received an emergency call from a neighbor saying someone was injured and bleeding at the stately brick home in the Windsor Terrace neighborhood. When they arrived, they found Margaret Devaney, 57, stabbed in the eye and abdomen. Raymond Devaney, 70, had been stabbed in the throat. Police said Margaret Devaney went out the front door covered in blood and called out to her neighbor who came outside and saw the couple collapsed on the porch. Neighbors said they saw Ryan Devaney walking quickly from the home, his hands covered in blood. He told one passerby he had, quote, done something bad. According to police, as he made his way to the subway station at 15th Street and Prospect Park West, where he jumped onto the tracks and was hit by a G train during the morning rush hour. They believe he was trying to kill himself. Witnesses told police they saw a burst of feathers from his down jacket above the tracks.
Oh, it's wrong to laugh. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Be sure to join us tomorrow tomorrow we will be graced by the presence of Daniel and Anton from Sorrell's Vintages.
Oh, awesome.
So that'll be tomorrow. Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig be in the studio with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 this Friday, talking about the life, work, and legacy of Mr. Eddie Murphy. Who was funny once upon a time, many years ago.
He did other good stuff besides being Donkey in Shrek.
What is is the would you agree that The Nutty Professor is the last good Eddie Murphy film?
I wouldn't even say that.
Really?
I would not call Nutty Professor a good
A big fan of that film.
No, I'm not.
I see, the mark to me, the mark of a good comedy is whether or not I laugh at it. And so it's hard to make me belly laugh. And that movie really, really did. I found it. Now, see, I can get you. I see you getting that judgmental look on your face.
No, comedy is very subjective. It really is. I rarely judge people on comedies they like. I'm just sitting here thinking about it. I was actually just thinking, it's like, no, for me, that would have been the point at which I think he started the slide, was actually Nutty Professor. But, you know.
Here's the look on your face, though. The look on your face just now, and I will take your word that you're not judging me in some sort of a malicious sense. But the look on your face, if I had to caption it right now, would have been, well, let me recalculate Rick Emerson's comedy appreciation tote board. Wait, 72. Ooh, down 3 points.
I admit I was a little surprised.
It was like you were assessing me right there, not
the
movie.
Might have been a little surprised. Yeah. But no, I, you know, again, comedy is very subjective. And I learned a long time ago that you got to give people a lot of slack when it comes to comedy.
Even if there was nothing else in the movie that I found redeeming, and the sequel to it was terrible, and the Dr. Dolittle movies were awful, and I think it was about the time he did Haunted Mansion that I just said, like, I'm not seeing anything he does like ever again. And I, for one, and I was also not brought around by his performance in Dreamgirls, which everybody kept trying to tell me was like the redemption of Eddie Murphy, which was just a terrible movie, like in every regard.
Now you got to go back to like Trading Places and 48 Hours and
unassailable classics.
You know, yeah.
I mean, just brilliant in every way. The thing, the one thing about Nutty Professor, I will say that, regardless of anything else in the, or irregardless, as they say in Malala, of anything else in the film. The thing about Nutty Professor that sold me on that, even just as an isolated scene, it's the whole. It's not even a subplot, but it's that device of when he goes into the comedy club and Dave Chappelle is up on stage doing the comedy, and he goes in the first time as Sherman Klump or whatever, and he gets reamed, and then he goes in the second time as Buddy Love. To me, I thought that was great because that was a little bit of commentary and criticism on like several different levels. First of all, I thought it was. Murphy or perhaps because did he write The Nutty Professor?
Well, if he isn't the writer on record, he certainly, you know, has an enormous amount of input.
Yeah, I mean, he had a strong hand in that, at least. Movies, yeah. So it seemed like that was partially Murphy's commentary on the current state of comedy, specifically, the sort of like deaf comedy jam school of, school of humor, which is that, you know, that's where I get the whole women be shopping thing. Also, it's great just to see Dave Chappelle, they're just really just grabbing onto this horrible, unfunny, unlikable character with both hands and just giving it all he's got, just embodying the character. But it was Murphy's comment on the current comedy scene. And I also thought, plus it's an incredibly satisfying, just in terms of the filmic structure, of a setup and payoff later where he goes in and he just gets reamed by the comedian and then he goes back later and, you know, and he's sort of, you know, he turns the tables in a hilarious fashion. And so that is just satisfying as a moviegoer. I thought that they actually set that up and they played out the string on that really well. I also thought, though, that it functioned a little bit as an observation by Murphy to the audience about himself, that he was trying to remind people that he was once upon a time a stand-up comic and was really funny and was really influential. I thought it was just a little bit of a flag planting or of a. You know, it just sort of spiking the ball, a little bit, just to kind of remind people of who he, who he was and who he used to be. And maybe, maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe I'm not. But I thought I found that to be not only funny, but actually really fascinating. So the whole movie's worth the price of admission. And then it's like I made the mistake of seeing the sequel, the clumps or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's. You know, it's like the worst thing they ever did for that guy was let him make Coming to America, which is, again, a movie that I like a lot. But goddamn, the whole thing of like that he's one guy playing nine guys. It just needs to be – that needs to be smothered like now. That needs to be put down as a device.
Yeah, that almost never works. And that's one of the reasons I don't really care for The Nutty Professor is a lot of that – it just – that's not something I really care for as a rule. I think the only exception I can think of in – recent memory, and this isn't even that recent, is the first Austin Powers film, where you've got somebody who's playing multiple characters, and it's still funny, at least to me. But only the first one, because there's the whole law of diminishing sequels with the Austin Powers movies, where it's like the second one is only half as funny as the first one, and the third one blows.
I got to say that for me, Austin Powers is one of those movies where I And I just don't get it. I just lack the receptor. I don't dislike Mike Myers, and I don't dislike big, broad, dumb, obvious comedy. I mean, I'm a child of Mel Brooks like everybody else. I have no issue with that. There's just – but as you guys said, comedy is so subjective. By all right, if you look at Austin Powers, those movies, the first one especially, on paper, I should have loved it. There's nothing about that movie – that I should dislike, and yet the sum total is just like a soda that has no pop to me. Yeah. It's, you know, there's nothing there.
I became non-judgmental about comedy when I saw so many people who I respect and actually, actually have, honest respect for, find Farrelly Brothers movies funny.
Right.
And I don't. And I just don't. And I realize there's some kinds of comedy I just don't find funny. I don't find humiliation humor funny. I don't find bodily function
flatulence,
humor funny.
Not funny.
Just and that's – but then again, that's a very personal thing. And so it's like – I remember when There's Something About Mary came out and people were just raving about it. And I just didn't – there's maybe two scenes in that I found – somewhat amusing. I really didn't like it at all. Then a month or two later, Basketball came out, which I thought was awesome.
And there's a guy,
and people just nobody got it.
And
nobody
it
cared.
Features somebody drinking Ernest Borgnine's fat out of a bag, right?
Yes.
Isn't it at one point Matt Stone drinking Ernest Borgnine's liposuction fat out of a plastic bag?
Yeah, it is like the only good movie role that you'll ever see Jenny McCarthy in.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, no, that I love that movie, and people were like, I thought it was dumb. I'm like, really? But you liked Something About Mary.
I'm
really
so glad they were on the same page here, because I love Basketball. And it's not even that I disliked Something About Mary, because that's too strong of a word for it. It's like it was just indifferent. It just left me cold. And plus, did you get this feeling, and I suspect you did, that, see, I'm so glad to know that I'm not alone in this, because I have been for years on the with Something About Mary, I felt a little bit like I sometimes feel when I am reading Doonesbury, that I know that somewhere in there is a joke happening. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling sometimes that I am – like when I was watching Something About Mary, I got the feeling I was just supposed to laugh at a guy who was on crutches because that was funny in and of itself. That – you know, there's the guy who's on the weird braces and he turns out to be the villain or whatever the end. And he would come on the screen and there would be laughter in the audience. And I remember thinking, okay, there is either something in this scene that I'm not – that I'm not seeing, that I'm not catching it. It's happening somewhere. It's a kind of humor so subtle. They're threading the comedic needle so carefully that I'm not getting it, or it's an inside reference, or it's just supposed to be funny that there's a guy who's on crutches. And I got the feeling it was the latter. And I'm with you. A, it's not funny, and I know this sounds dumb coming from me, but it just sort of it makes me sound like such a hypocrite to say that it offends me, but it kind of does, because it offends me also just comedically, because it's just so non-interesting to me. Like farting is just – flatulence is just – it's offensive to me, like in a creative sense, because there's just – that just proves to me you just have no ideas. There's nothing going on in your head, and so you're going to have a guy just go on the screen and go, it's comedy, which is what the second Nutty Professor did. And I took my mom to see that. And then there's just an endless sequence of, like, Eddie Murphy is various fat members of his family sitting around the table passing wind. Mm. And I was just thinking to myself, oh, I've chosen so poorly here. All right. I'm glad we're on the same page there. Good for you, Don Taylor.
Thank you.
You're a good person. Let me just say we're going to roll the top five here in just one moment. The top five brought to you by our good friends at Squires Electric. They help to make all of this cultural observation possible. 503-25. And you're right about Jenny McCarthy, by the way. She was really good in Basketball, which I think the only thing that she's ever done that was decent, like, in any way.
Yeah.
That's that whole thing about, like, you know, every band, no matter how bad they are, they have one good single in them somewhere. That's like my thing with Kate Hudson. She had the one good movie. Jenny McCarthy, the one good movie. And leave it to Trey Parker and Matt Stone to be in the project that actually gets the good performance out of her. 503-252-1609. That is the number for Squires Electric. You can find out more about them by going to SquiresElectric.com. We know from now, and as we've said before, when you listen to us talk about Squires Electric, you listen to us talk about Christmas Mountain Trees or Sorrells, wherever it is, you know, it sounds cheesy, but it's true that, you know, they're not just business partners, they're also listeners. Joe Squire's been listening to this show for, God, he's wasted 13 years of his life listening to this dumb program.
Has he?
He was a young man with hope and spark when he started listening to me, and now
fixing submarines and listening to you.
And I was going to say, years later, now look at him, he's rich and owns his own company.
So he didn't exactly waste that time, did he?
No.
Maybe you were the inspiration for him to to do more.
Some sort of an electric succubus. he's taken all my inspiration and made it his own.
For the love of God, I don't want to be like that guy.
I want to be some unemployed slack-ass DJ. God damn, I better get a degree in something. And he did. He is a licensed, bonded, insured electrical supervisor. Thank you for putting that in the right context for me. Electrical supervisor, installer, and contractor. That is a thing that defeats, that bests 97% of people when they take the test. He, of course, passed it the first time. But we know a lot of people in the audience, you know, are like, you know, they're like squires. They're like, you know, like Castalia Language, and they're like, you know, Christmas Mountain Trees. They're business owners. They're business operators. They also happen to be listeners. So by definition, right now, I'm speaking to you, there's a good chance that you either, you know, you're a decision maker at a place, or you manage. Maybe you have your own business. Maybe you're going to think about starting your own business, like a lot of people are, trying to figure out what they're going to do with you know, the rest of their lives, you know, and thinking about putting together their own operation. When it comes to, you know, whether you're getting a building, whether you're starting a facility, maybe you're expanding your business, you know, what it looks like on the outside is great. What goes on inside that you don't necessarily see, equally important, if not more so. That's where Squires Electric comes in. So you contact them about all the wiring in your business or your home, whether it's a new building or whether you're revamping it, re-updating it, you're remodeling it, you're expanding it. 503-252-1609 is our phone number, 503-252-1609, or SquiresElectric.com. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. They are a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Please tell me you heard it here, won't you? SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
What's that?
Like usual?
I don't think, is it, don't I usually do it from the top down?
Well, it doesn't matter, you numbered them.
No, but that's thrown, I think that's thrown you off in the past, where I handed you
recently
the top five and you go, well, this is done all wrong, and then I'm just filled with shame.
Well, I do know, though, that we start with five and work our way to one. Well, so if you've numbered them one through five.
So I would think, but that helps, you've been flummoxed by that in the past. The orientation of it has thrown you off. I'm trying to make it easy for you. Get off my back! Sorry. All right.
There's no honorable mention.
I need some more. Do you have more criticisms you'd like to level?
You're gonna come over and just, I don't like this font.
Just come over and kick me in the shins? Why'd you do that, huh? Why don't you just come over and spit at me? No, and I'll do it for you.
What's with the Helvetica? It's always with the Helvetica with you.
Damn, Rick Emerson. Puh! Puh! I think we need some more caffeine. Man, can I just tell you? I know that I'm not the one in the hospital, and I'm not the one whose husband was having his abdomen perforated. God damn, this has been like a long 10 days or so. It's just like sucked the life out of everybody. And again, I'm not putting myself in the same position, but it just, but you know, that there's stress like all around right now.
Do you have any idea how tired I am?
I mean, it's just, I mean, look, I'm tired, and basically I just sit here and I sort of mention Patrick, and then I go home and I watch House for a couple hours, and I'm exhausted. I'm not even really having to do anything. I just hear about it, and then I go home and I sleep, and I have nachos.
I'm like walking hospital corridors and living on bad coffee and not sleeping, and it's like, and I'm here, though.
That's right. You're playing through the pain, Dawn.
Entertain the people.
That's right, because the show must go on. All right. These are the top five sick songs. And so the only unifying theme here is really the word sick in the title. I had an honorable mention, frankly, and I'll just tell you what it was. The honorable mention I have, which I guess I could have gotten away with because he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now or whatever, it was Alice Cooper, which is Sick Things, which is just not a very good song. And I love Alice Cooper. It's just not a very good song. And you know what? I didn't want to put it on just for the sake of having six.
And I'm not going to give it away, but I will say that when you told me the theme, there was one song that immediately jumped to mind, which is a song I love, 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 love.
I know which one it is.
And it's number one.
I know.
It's
I knew it.
One.
See, tell me, Rick. Don't you feel bad for making fun of my font now?
So I'm starting at the bottom.
Come over there. I'm going to cut out your windpipe. I swear to God. And, you know, the only complaining you'll be making then will just sound kind of sort of a thing.
Right. Number five.
God. All right. Be like that episode of MASH where Radar does the thing with the ballpoint pen in the back of the Jeep. With this pen right here.
Okay. That's not a ballpoint pen, though.
I swear to God, I'm going to come over there. I'm going to do something so horrible to you. I don't even know what it is, but it's going to involve you. And the rest I'll make up as I go along. All right. Can we go home yet? I don't ever say that.
We're almost there.
I swear to God, there's something in the air. It's just there's something. Whatever Patrick had might be, it must be catching or something. I feel like I got holes in my brain today.
Did your gallbladder feel swollen?
It does. These are the top five songs with sick in the title. And I'll tell you, by the way, just as a further preamble, I don't even like this number five song. That's how objective Rick Emerson tries to be about these things. I don't even really care for this song that's number five. But it's got to be on here because otherwise it would be a musically dishonest list.
And there'd only be four.
That's right. And then I'd get the Slayer guy or his less impressive younger brother emailing me about the absence of this.
There was a great Iron Maiden song you could have put on there and you missed it.
Seriously. All right. Here's your top five. Blah, 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 blah.
Number five, Disturbed.
So beyond caring at this point.
Down with the sickness.
It's not like I dislike Disturbed. They're okay. I have said this about Disturbed. If I were 14 and a half again, this would be the greatest band I'd ever heard in my life. I mean, you know Disturbed. The guy kind of does the whole, like, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom animal noise approach to singing.
They don't really do much for me.
They're a fine band. They make some quality, sort of metal-ish music. Again, you know, if I was like an embittered teenager, I think this would be awesome. And I'm not trying to be snarky, but I know I sound like a dick when I say that. And I'm really not. Because music...
No, you are.
It's like when you're talking about comedy. Music is really subjective. Yeah. And right now, there's somebody out there, Disturbed is like their favorite band and whatever. And I can see that. You know what it is? This is sort of like... This is like when you are hearing, when you're hearing a band like this. To me, it's like looking at a painting that's through like plexiglass, where it's like you can kind of get a sense of it, you know, but you can't really get close enough to touch it or to get a sense of the texture or to, you know, and you can't take any flash photos of it for analysis later. I can understand why this appeals to people because it would have appealed to me at a certain point, but I think I have left the stage in my life in which I go home and I put on, like, the 10,000 Fists album and I stomp around pretending that I'm Satan with, like, a towel around my neck, you know? Which is a thing I used to do, by the way.
Did you?
Yes.
How old were you when you stomped around pretending you were Satan with a towel around your neck?
Here's what I'll do, Don. I will answer that question this way. I've resisted doing this just because then it, I don't know, because then it makes me look like just some guy who's so up his own ass that it's, you know, I'll bring in a copy of Bigger Than Jesus, which you've never seen, which is a one-man show that I did. And that activity, which I really did at one point, that is depicted at one point with full musical accompaniment. So you'll get a little window into what 14-year-old Rick was like.
Okay.
And I was exactly like the guy who listens to this. And sort of like, you know, broods around his bedroom pretending that he's like, you know, wandering the halls of a castle on the shores of Loch Ness. You know, like wailing at God from a high atop a mountain in a lightning storm. I'm sorry, I keep sounding like a dick. What are you going to do? All right, blah, 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 anger, anger, blah, 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 angst, angst. These are the top five songs with sick in the title. Don Taylor, we're at number four. What might number four be? A
huge change of pace. Number four, Matthew Sweet, Sick of Myself.
Seriously, I mean, there's, you know, the order sort of dictates that this train wreck segue happened, but...
Got a little whiplash from that segue.
I love Matthew Sweet.
I do, too.
I'm the biggest Matthew Sweet fan. I mean, when he started just doing all of these weird Phil Spector type records, I kept buying his stuff. This is one of the best pop songs ever. And lest anybody think that this is just like some sort of a nostalgia trip, I'm the first one to admit that most of the 90s is just like a musical wasteland to me. Most of like the alt rock thing that was happening, like that whole like Lollapalooza generation, most of the music is just so bad. It's just so irredeemable to me in, like, every way. But in the midst of just this sea of tuneless, you know, like, atonal, gray-tinged crap, there was, like, this bright, shining beacon of, what do you call that thing, melody? And one of those guys was Matthew Sweet. Created just some fantastic... And the thing about this song is it's so pretty and beautiful and catchy. And it's a sweet song, no pun intended. It's got a very, very sweet melody and layered Beach Boys harmonies. But then it's, like, so loud and trashy sounding. And that's all the production of Brendan O'Brien on that, where he's just got this great, loud, echoing guitar and drum sound. It sounds so messy, but it works flawlessly.
Don't know.
this came out sort of in the same general time that we were just being surrounded by, like, I don't know, it's like a... It was like a bunch of records. It just sounded like somebody had left an electric shaver next to the microphone, and there's a lot of I'd had enough of that. And when I heard Matthew Sweet, and the Girlfriend record had already come out, but I think this was the first record of hers that I actually Matthew Sweet that I actually heard, and it was just. It was like hearing, it was like a sort of an updated Raspberries or Cheap Trick thing.
Yeah.
And it really was, it was just like a little exhale, you know? And it was just, you know, the midst of just all of this, like, really off-putting drony stuff that was coming out. I'm a big fan of that guy. And then he did these records with Susanna Hoffs later that were just fantastic as well. You got Sick of Myself. That's from the album 100% Fun, by the way, you kids. Matthew Sweet. These are the, and it has 5 false endings, by the way. So you got to give it up for that. There's just one. There we go. These are the top 5 sick songs here on the Rick Emerson Radio Pro program. Don Taylor.
Number 3, Led Zeppelin, Sick Again.
This is off Physical Graffiti. This is the final song on the second album of Physical Graffiti.
Speaking of guitars.
Yeah. This is about... This is all about groupies at the Continental Hyatt House, or Riot House. Wait for it.
One day soon, you're gonna reach 16.
There you go. I think it was a different time when you could sing about your girlfriend and how one day, and you were like a 25-year-old rock singer, and how one day soon she was gonna reach 16, and not that soon, by the way.
Yeah.
You know what I haven't seen yet is that that documentary. What is the guitar? Is it It's Gonna Get Loud? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And it's Jimmy Page, The Edge, and Jack White.
Yeah. It's good. It's really interesting. It's really good.
I mean, you want to talk about 4 guys who just, like, made more noise than any 4 guys should have been able to make.
By the way, you're doing the top 5 songs with Sick in the title for my husband, Patrick, because he's in the hospital.
That's right.
And, last Christmas, when I was, like, bugging him about Christmas presents and going, what do you want? I don't know what you want for Christmas. Just give me some idea. And he kind of racked his brain. And he told me the only thing he could think of that he really, really wanted was he wanted the remastered Physical Graffiti.
This is such a great record. It's hands down my favorite Led Zeppelin record. And it's almost cheating because it's a double album. But there's a lot of double albums that are just not very good. And, I mean, it's just... Also, I believe this... I think was the first Led Zeppelin album that I bought, that I owned with my own money. My friend had lent me his Zeppelin 4, of course. But then I went out and I was like, I got to hear more of this band. I have to buy everything they've ever done. And this is the one I started with because it was the double album, so I thought the most for my money. And it's just fantastic. It's just such a great record.
Since you've done this, since you were 13.
Again with the 13. And Jimmy Page, by the way, at this point, we should say, in the band's career, was in fact dating a 13-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Dating a girl named Lori Maddox, who I saw interviewed just a few years ago, who, in all fairness, did not really look like the 13s that they grew in my city, but still. Who he met by kidnapping. He had the road manager kidnap her, not really at gunpoint, but, I mean, there was really no choice given to her. And then they just threw her into a limo and then just, like, threw her into his hotel room and shut the door. And he was just sort of waiting there, like, in a blackened hotel room surrounded by candles and tapping a cane on the floor. That's the way she tells the story.
Dear Lord.
And he's all like, I am Jimmy Page. We are going to have sex now. You know, and it was just, you know, or whatever.
Did he say it in that accent? Because that would be awesome.
Like Ricardo Montalban.
Yes. I am Jimmy Page.
She said that she goes into the hotel room. The room is dark. He's surrounded by candles. He's got a hat pulled down over his eyes. He's tapping a cane on the floor for some reason. And then he just had a bunch of, like, skulls and Aleister Crowley books, like, littered around the bed. And he's all like, now is sex time. And she was like, well, all right. All right. See, this is how I can turn people around. There's somebody screaming at me in the text box about Kiss and about how I'm a douche. But then I turned him around with the page. He says, Page is the man. Indeed he is, sir. These are the top five sick songs. Don Taylor, where are we now on the list?
We're at number one.
No, we're not.
Number two, excuse me. Number two is Aerosmith, Sick as a Dog.
This is Sick as a Dog off the Rocks album, widely considered to be the best of the Aerosmith records. This is where Stephen Tyler really gets like the great. He is so great with the turns of phrase, and I mean not just when he's being interviewed about boning chicks in hotel elevators.
Yeah.
Memoirs. But there's this line in the song when he's talking about a girl, of course, who is, you know, he's trying to get the lady and is having, I think, some difficulty with that. And that line where he says, it's a shame you're so refined, which is, there's just something about that. I think it's coming up later, but he says, please, it's a shame you're so refined. And I don't even really know what that means, like, in the context of this song or, like, who he was singing about or who he was addressing. But it's like there's just something about that that is really, really great, especially if you're a teenage boy and it's like all the girls that you're really into, they just, like, none of them will talk to you and they're all, like, beyond your grasp and you just can't seem to, you know. And it's because you're just some dirtbag, basically, you know. And it's, like at that moment, Stephen is speaking for all of us.
If you were just a little trashier.
That's right. And that does work, by the way. That equation holds true. If they're a little trashier or a lot trashier, I was going to reveal what a friend of mine used to say about women who smoke, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. These are the top five songs with sick in the title, and then you get to leave, Don.
Yes.
What is...
And I get to leave on a song that I love.
What is number one, Don Taylor?
Number one is Social Distortion, Sick Boys.
One of the classic guitar noises coming up right here. I don't know who the first guy was that discovered he could scrape his pick down the strings and make that noise.
Yeah.
And if that guy gets a royalty, and you know he doesn't.
No.
It's probably Les Paul. God, where would rock and roll be without the pick scrape?
They're coming to town, apparently.
Are they?
Yeah, Social Distortion.
Man, those guys never get off the road. They tour constantly. I love Social Distortion, and I especially love Social Distortion at this era.
Yes.
When they had that perfect balance between country and punk going on. And I love the Somewhere Between Heaven and Hell record. I love a lot of the things they've done after that. But you know, this record had that perfect confluence. It was like I think Katie Lang called it cowpunk, and it was just, it was never again quite so magical as it was on this album. And it has a lot of OAOs all over it. Yeah, yes. Come on, how great is that?
Yes.
It's the best thing ever. That's like as good as it gets. There's just, I mean,
yes.
Somebody once said that the definition of a good punk song is that while you're listening to it, you are convinced it's the greatest song that has ever been recorded. And this totally meets that standard. Awesome. We'll wrap it up now. Make room for Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler. They're going to be in with funemploymentradio.com. That'll be up this afternoon around 6 p.m. Pacific time. Join us tomorrow when our guests will be Anton and Daniel from Swirls Vintages. We'll talk about the correct holiday purchase for your loved one this holiday season. On Friday, we'll talk to Mr. Big Jim Willig. He'll be here with another installment of Humory Comedy 101, talking about the career of Eddie Murphy. Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill. Executive producer, Bruce Agler. And chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from y'all. Thank you for listening. It is Wednesday, December 15th, 2010. And that is The Frequency, Kenneth. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.